Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. Oh boy, here we go. This is going to be a really exciting week. A whole bunch of things are happening that are just fabulous. One, tomorrow, Christina Bob, Trump's attorney, reporter, just all-around fascinating person, retired Marine from the JAG unit, and just she'll be here tomorrow. Gregory Wrightstone, CO2 Coalition. We're going to dispel a bunch of the stuff about you know, all the myths of CO2 and how CO2 is a good thing. Without it, the plants die, and when the plants die, we die. And we're going to put it really simply that if you don't have CO2, you don't have a carbon cycle. If you don't have a carbon cycle, you don't have life on planet Earth. And these idiots, these morons, are trying to take that away from us. And we'll talk about that too. So they're either stupid or dangerous or both. I guess dangerously stupid comes to mind. But I got a thrill. I'm really excited about this. I'm going to bring her on right now. Jessica Rivera, who's on the show once before, is going to add a whole new dimension of reporting. She's got broadcast journalism experience. She's a political correspondent, and it's really great to have her. Jessica, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Greg. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Let's give you a round of applause. There we go. So I'm going to make you a theme. So everybody here gets a theme. So I've got news themes. I've got music. So we're going to pick one, and we'll say some like really good things about you. Let me see. I'm going to play one right here. That one's too long. This is the one I like. How about this? And now the Rivera Report with Jessica Rivera. Does this sound good? Isn't that newsy?
I love it. And very, very, after that, I better have a really, really good story to tell. That's quite an introduction.
Well, I'll work on it, but I'll think about it. We got to get a theme here. In fact, I think one of the things I want to talk about today is your report. And it's really funny that a lot of the talking I do with my reporters is on the air. It's like we don't have a lot of private conversations. Mm-hmm. We do the off-the-air message stuff like that. But the actual chance we get to talk in detail, it's right here. So everybody's listening, you know, in Azerbaijan and Cuba and Thailand and New Zealand and all the other places we reach. It's really quite fascinating. Anyway, so let's go with background on you, just to reintroduce you to everybody so they know what's going on, especially when Marco joins us. Marco's a friend in the Netherlands. He's always typing in and looking up stuff for us. He's kind of like our on-the-air live chat person. So let's kind of reintroduce you.
Okay, so obviously I have a journalism background. I've worked in broadcasting and broadcast news specifically, originally from Los Angeles, California. So I did some over there in LA, Orange County, before I moved to Colorado, specifically Denver. And then while out here in Denver, I worked with a couple broadcasting networks, specifically Weather Nation and Real America's Voice. And then when that ended, I am currently a political correspondent for Right Side Broadcasting. So whenever they kind of need me, I, you know, run out and do some coverage. And that's really where we're at right now. And now I'm kind of doing some investigative reporting for you now.
Which is absolutely fascinating. And I want to thank you for that.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that's been missing. You know, a lot of us here, like I say, I'm sort of, you know, jokingly say I'm uniquely unqualified for everything I do. I don't have a broadcast degree. I don't have a communications degree. I don't have a law degree, yet I've written more legislation than any member of Congress at this point. It's really fascinating. I don't have an economics degree. We talk about that every Friday. It's just, you know, I don't have a science degree. Well, I've got an environmental studies degree, but I don't have a real science degree yet. We're going to talk climate change. In fact, you with Weather Nation might be, if you want to get a question to Gregory Wrightstone, that'd be great. Tell me about that for a second. I'm kind of curious. With your experience in Weather Nation, did that give you some insight into this whole climate fraud that's being perpetuated on us and the fact that carbon, you know, carbons are our, life is carbon. We are carbon. The air is carbon. The plants are carbon. We're all carbon. How can these idiots think that getting rid of carbon dioxide is somehow a good thing? Anyway, yeah, tell me.
So while I was there, and that was a few years ago, they kind of steered away from it. They just did. It was like, you know, we're going to give people what they need in a concise report, very clear. We're not going to get into anything kind of that's going to be controversial of some sort. If people wanted to talk about a climate, you know, change in regards to not the climate change that you're talking about, but a climate change in, you know, this is not a normal for this area, which lots of times that does happen. Things change, you know, obviously the earth has cycles and so does the weather.
Right.
But really they didn't get into it. So nobody at the time really had to really deal with it or agree. I think the newsroom was probably kind of split, if I remember, on who believed what, but it really didn't come up. Everybody was just, you know, and they did need a weather for pretty much, let's see, the U.S. We talked international weather, and then they did weather for the Bahamas and the Caribbean and those areas. So they were busy just, you know, trying to get that information. It wasn't weather in one specific location. It was all over. So there was so much to cover that really that didn't have a lot of time to kind of poke up. So
interesting. Well, we're going to change all that. This is actually media. We don't care. Politics is, and you know, I made a thing on Facebook last night that the only climate change that people can really affect is the political climate. It's the only thing you can change with legislation.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Now, did you come to the weather broadcasting out of an interest in weather, a science background, or is it just a place that you really, it was a good opportunity to get started in broadcast journalism?
So, I had already done broadcast journalism back in Los Angeles and Orange County on a very local
right.
level, doing just general assignment reporting, and then a little bit of anchoring here and there, but nothing too involved. So when I came out here to Denver, I realized that news just works completely different, right? It's
really?
Not like a Los Angeles. Yes, in LA, you could see a new person every week and nobody really says anything, right? Out here in and
in
a lot of other areas.
Back in America.
In a lot of other places, you see the same news team. It's not really theatrical or it's not really Hollywood-ish. Like it can be over there in Southern California. So with that being said, I realized that out here, they didn't really just bring people on to contract work or they didn't bring people on to just do this and that and try them out like can happen in Southern California. So there for a few years, I kind of did my own thing, kind of realized, okay, well, it's quite different here. And then one day I just got a posting kind of like a information about Weather Nation needing a producer. And so I figured I would try it out, and I did, and they gave me the position, and I did that for quite a few years. And I ended up going to Mississippi State's meteorology certificate program, and I honestly still need to finish that.
We all have work to do. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. When I was going to finish, I had actually come on to Real America's Voice, the political side, and I had really, really enjoyed it. And it was election year, so kind of put things off a little.
Maybe we have more impact in politics than the weather. I mean, you know, everybody reports on the weather, but you can't change it. You know, politics, at least we can have an impact on. Well, the reason I ask, as you were talking, I was thinking it would be fascinating to have a CO2 report. I mean, nobody does that.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's up to you. I mean, it's your report. I love making suggestions. And tell me when I've made too many, because that's another thing I'm really guilty of.
I was going to say, you really do love suggestions, but I love it because you're always thinking and you always want to add something new. So,
well, see, that's one of my contradictions is that I'll say, it's your report, do what you want. And then they'll give you like 15 things, you know, to think about. That's
just
normal.
Do this.
Okay.
Just do it as I say.
No, nothing. But I'm not, and I don't want to tell you what to. But in other words, yeah. I mean, these are ideas, and if you know, you're free to accept or not. You probably have better ones, and that's okay. That's just me. That's just how I operate because I have so many ideas. You know, I mean, God dumped this you know idea like gene into me. It's just, and I don't know where it comes from, but it's you know try being in my brain. It's not. It's very crowded. There's a lot of stuff going on.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. We just Marco just checked in from the Netherlands, so we know he's there too. He says he's not always on his computer, so he may not be. Marco, you don't have to look up everything. It's okay. We'll just listen and have some fun. This is so weird. I'll tell you, cause I grew up with, you know, rotary dial phones when I was a kid. All right. So the ability mm-hmm. to sit here on a computer, on a microphone, talking directly to somebody in the Netherlands, you know, who I haven't heard from yet, voice to voice, because he's on live chat. This is staggering to me. And the technology is amazing.
It is. Yeah. It's amazing what we can do today. Mm-hmm. With technology, like you said, especially in TV. And I think, you know, pandemic being good or bad for people, whatever, however people want to, you know, whatever their experience was in it. I do really believe it took broadcasting, whether that's radio, TV, to a whole mm-hmm. new level of what we can do, especially with the Zooms now and the, you know, the different ways of reaching out and seeing people on video and, so it really is amazing.
Well, I mean, look at me. Like I say, I'm not a professionally trained video person or broadcaster or radio or anything. I mean, I had six shows I did in Bakersfield. Was the extent of my experience before I got the job at WBY. So a little radio station here. Still my favorite job in radio when I working for somebody else because it was fabulous. But it's just, you know, I mean, I do videos. You know, we're pioneers here. We're broadcasting in ways that have never been done or never even thought of by actually becoming advocates. So before I get to your ideas, I really will, like, just this is probably the next question after this one. But do you wonder, as I do, that the left broadcasting is completely activist? It's propagandistic. It's propagandistic. There we go. It's directed. It's almost like an adjunct arm of the Democrat Party, which is, you know, part of the world communist movement. I mean, I'll be blunt. But the news is directly incorporated into a political agenda, whereas on the conservative side of broadcasting, they're still in this world of objectivity, which doesn't exist. It's almost like they're 30 years behind the times. And my hope is that conservative broadcasters will become conservative news advocates. So for every problem, there is a solution. For every everything that people report on, they say, well, here are some possible ways out of this. You know, or here's what the government could do better. Or here's where the corporation screwed up or something like that. But get into the solutions. Get beyond this pretense of objectivity that really doesn't exist anymore. So like I say, if you want to report on the broadcast industry itself, especially at the conservative side, that would be fascinating too.
I definitely think you have a point there. I was just actually speaking with my husband the other day, and I said, you know, it's so sad that we've come to a day where it's division instead of saying, you know what, we will happily welcome both liberal, conservative, and, you know, sides to come on and, you know, report their stories. They don't mm-hmm. have to be so you know, fighted in what they believe, but it's okay to, you know, at this point, okay to know how people feel politically and kind of have them in all one newsroom and really give the people, your audience, the power to kind of say what they like, what they don't like, what they want to see, what they don't want to see. But that's not how it is. Obviously, we know that mainstream media is very much liberal, more Democrat, and I think it's very much changing, and it's had to change for a while now. It's not as popular, obviously, to be a conservative mm-hmm. reporter, but I think people are getting more used to it and are appreciating the fact that more people who are conservative and are coming out and being vocal about it, because I think there for a while a lot of people didn't want to have any sort of notoriety about it, because you are blacklisted pretty much in this industry, and it's not a good thing to do in this industry. But I think right now people are getting used to the fact that it's an up-and-coming type of news. You know, things are going to change, and I see them continuing.
Yeah, you look at Fox News. You know, the more liberal they get, mm-hmm. the more their audience goes to Newsmax and One America. So the knowledge, you know, the need for people to have alternative reporting. We actually have, you know, we have Bianca von Krieg, who's a mm-hmm. West Coast progressive socialist trans activist on the show. Mm-hmm. You know, we cover everything.
And I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think it's
we don't
great
agree on hardly anything.
Have a...
It's really fun.
No, and you don't have – this is
but that's
the thing.
Okay.
I think
yeah.
it's Yeah, I think if you want to have a conversation to always get people to agree with you, you're going to have a hard time in life because it's really not how it works. Lots of times dialogue is just to get to understand somebody's viewpoint. You may never understand it, never agree with them, but it's always nice to just hear it and understand and just know that there's people that think differently. Of course, you're not going to agree with them. You're probably not going to hang out with them or, you know, spend your off time with them.
Well, that'd be interesting.
But I mean,
next time I'm in San Francisco.
You can appreciate other people's thoughts. Appreciating other people's ideas, and that's what America is. You can have those. Yeah.
Well, I think I want to understand, and I think I do. But from Bianca, we get these incredible insights into the Democrats and the progressives that no conservatives should ever hear, simply because they don't have, you know, people with different viewpoints on, which is crazy. Speaking of different viewpoints, enough of me. What's been on your mind? What you've been looking into? What do you have for us this morning?
So my story this morning would be the newest no cash bail law just went into effect last Monday. Yes.
Uh-huh.
And for some people, they may say, who cares? You know, like, what is that really? How does that really affect my life? It's really not important.
Oh, we care. This is a very sophisticated audience.
We get really intelligent
people out there. Anyway, but I never talk down to people. So you can be as complex and detailed and intricate. And we got a legal report following you. So
awesome.
I might ask Jonathan the same questions. This is kind of cool. So tell me what happened. Yeah.
Yeah, so it went into effect. It's a no cash bail law, and Illinois is the first in the country to pass such a law. So they're going to be the example for the nation. It was actually voted in a couple years ago. It's part of a whole Pretrial Fairness Act, the section of the Safety Act, which they passed 2 years ago, effect last week. And basically what it does is when somebody is convicted of arrested of a crime in Illinois now.
Right.
If it is considered a nonviolent crime, then they are released free and just given, you know, here's your paper, here's your next court date, please show up.
What could go wrong?
Yeah, kind of like what's happening at the border, you know? With that, someone might say, well, you know, okay, so it's nonviolent. All right, well, let's start with that. The issue is drugs right now in America are a huge problem. And that is one of the offenses that is considered nonviolent. So the reality of that person going back out on the streets and reoffending and continuing to either deal drugs, buy drugs, whatever the situation is most likely going to continue. We know this in studies. Recidivism is, especially with somebody who has some sort of a rap sheet or a record. So there's that, which, you know, for many people, it may not affect them, but I think everybody at this point knows somebody or has had the experience themselves of a loved one dying of an overdose, fentanyl, things of that nature. And so is it really a nonviolent crime, I think, would be the question. So there's that. But then you go to the violent crime. Okay, well, let's specifically go to Chicago. Obviously, Illinois has the number one city in the U.S. for violent crime. So, and supposedly, this law is to keep minorities, specifically Blacks, Hispanics, out of jail because they say that they get higher, what is that called? They're given much higher bonds. They can't afford them.
It's
basically attack
time
on the poor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jailed for being Black kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah, that's
exactly.
But
what they don't explain or what a lot of people don't see is, if you go to a Chicago jail or, the area, you're probably going to see more Blacks, more Hispanics locked up. And it's just the demographics of the area most of the time. And
well, there's a reason
studies
too.
Show that
80%
of the
crime
in Chicago. So almost 80% of the crime in Chicago, and this is continuously for years now, 80% of the crime in Chicago that is committed by Blacks on Blacks.
Yeah.
But that's never brought up. you understand?
Oh, we do.
Like,
we talk about that.
Yeah,
all the time.
No. But what I'm saying is, you will never hear that in a mainstream media. They just make it seem like there's all these minorities in the jails, and then all of these white people are walking free, when that's not the reality of the situation. Yeah. There is a root problem. I think there's more than one problem, depending on how people look at it, and none of those problems are being addressed. It's just going straight to the end result and trying to make it right from there. And it doesn't, it obviously is not going to make any sense. So with that being said, of course, they're not going to be able to know how this pans out, right, for Illinois, specifically Chicago, until they can really study it for a few years. Obviously, it's only been in effect for 1 week. But if they're the number one, if Chicago is the number one in violent crime in the U.S. year in and year out, I don't understand how they think that this is going to help keep the minorities out of jail when those are the highest offenders. And they know this by studies. It's not just a hearsay or we think. These are studies that have been done. So it's really an interesting law. And the reason why I say it is because a lot of states are going to look at it and see, try to follow suit. And what is the motive, obviously, to return to your court date? If you know you're going to probably end up getting some sort of jail time or a fine or be on probation, there isn't anything there because nobody has signed for you. You haven't signed for yourself. So it's basically a get-out-of-jail-free ticket, even though they don't want people to think that that's what it is. It is. And those who are, quote-unquote, violent, being charged with violent crimes, they're just going to keep the jails, you know, crowded. So I don't – the nonsense of this law is it beside me. I mean, I think they know that it's not going to work. They're trying to say that it's a, you know, a justice reform. It's a civil rights, you know, law. When in reality, what it is for the specifically the people of Chicago, but the people of Illinois too, is it is a community. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people who lose their lives due to this new no cash bail law. And it's sad.
Oh, I agree.
That's what has to take place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the same thing with all the illegals coming across the border. I mean, the crime rate is going to skyrocket, and these people can just skip right back again. I wrote something down while you were talking. I wrote justice by quota. It's almost like the left looks at groups for everything. And if there are too many black people in jail, we have to reduce the number of black people in jail to be represented of the population. If there aren't enough black pilots, we need to put black people in the airline cockpits, whether they can fly or not. I mean, you know, and I used to be a flight instructor, and I taught everybody. All it mattered was, could you fly the airplane? That was my only criteria. I taught women. I said, you know, every group you can think of, older folks, younger folks. I had high school students. I had one guy in his 70s. And it didn't matter. It's just all it mattered was whether you could do it. You know, same thing. But if you look at everything by quota, I mean, everything. How many people are in school? How many people get college scholarships? How many government contracts should be issued? If everything is being reduced by the left to a quota, then if there are too many black and Hispanic people in jail simply, you know, because they committed the crimes, that's somehow wrong because it goes against the group. But I'm going to ask some follow-up questions on this, but do you see this as simple or as stupid as justice by quota?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you bring that up because if you do in any area, there's always going to be one group that is higher in something or lower in something than another. It's just the way it works, especially if you look at demographics. You know, if you look at, you know, certain areas of the country, if the demographic is more minorities live there, then that's probably going to be the highest number of whatever you're looking at. There's so much more that comes into play when they give people the outcome of these statistics or these reports. And lots of times people just take them for face value. And there's so much more that needs to be really reported in them. So, yes, I totally agree with you. It definitely is.
Interesting. Well, we've got time for that. I want to explore this too. Pianki's on live chat too, and he's our most regular caller and my friend, and it just, it really just, you know, helps the show out immensely. But he talks about this. He's in Missouri, and so this is a fascinating subject. We really need to look into this because nobody's actually doing the studies. Why is it that Chicago has, you know, such a high crime rate, especially black on black crime, especially young black men are killing other young black men at epidemic levels? And it, you know, it's here's my other, you know, nasty question. Do you think the government's doing this by design? Is this intentional, these crime rates?
You know, you would almost have to think possibly and more towards a yes. And the reason why I say that is because the first thing I would think of to try and combat the situation. Now, like I said, I don't think that there's one answer only and there's one problem. And so let's nip that one problem in the bud. I think this is years and years and years that have kind of compiled into make what the reality is now. First of all, let's look at the education system in Chicago, in some of these areas. Some of the worst schools, some of the worst reports coming out of there. But why are they not looking at that and saying, okay, why are we? Why don't we put more money or why don't we put more resources or try to figure out how we can get these kids the education that they need and that kids deserve in a public school? To make them competitive so that they're able to graduate at a, you know, a decent reading level, get into colleges. Now, I'm not saying that that's every person from Chicago. Like, that is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is a lot of these, if you take these people who have these criminal records, lots of times it's either they're dropouts or they just barely got through high school. And the reason why is because, you know, the teachers didn't want to deal with them anymore. I mean, it's going on now, so it's not that big of a mystery. So why don't we start there and then kind of see how that goes? But eventually, just going straight to the place, specifically where people are already committing crime, and that's kind of like their way of life, instead of going directly there where the loss is going to be greater, because the loss at that point is going to be people's lives. And I just don't think they take that very seriously. I don't think that it affects them. I don't think a lot of these supposed professionals who do these studies, they don't have to live in these communities. So they can make whatever rules they want because it doesn't affect them. Their family's not going to be affected. But for the people who are affected, they usually are the ones that don't have a say or a voice. And that's what's really, really sad and disheartening. Because I think if you really went into the communities there, they would probably agree with the fact that they need to start with better education for these kids. Now, I'm not saying that's the only problem that's there. I think there's a lot of other issues that we can, you know, go down a rabbit hole with. But I think that would be one huge area that they could start to try and, you know, rectify and make better.
We need to study that, too. Pianki's got a point here. He says the face of violent crime, murder in the U.S., is that of the black male, 15 to 34 years old. He says black, and Pianki's black. He says the black rate of murder is 207 per 100,000. For white males, it's 8 per 100,000. That's a huge difference. That's a massive difference.
Yeah, and that is the reason.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be, that's why, and people don't, like, take that into account or even know that information. So what they're just going to see is they're going to say, well, yeah, of course, if you look at this jail or you look at this prison, there's more blacks, there's more Hispanics. There's more. Well, yes, but there is a reason, you know, there's a reason why things are the way they are. Yes, there are the few. I think the exception to the rule of those who are innocently put in prison or innocently convicted of something. Absolutely. I do not deny that at all. But that is not the majority of people who are there in jail or prison or who are committing crimes. That is really a rare situation. But I think they want to try and convince the public that that's the reality. And it really isn't.
Well, let's take a look at this. A couple of things come to mind. One, and I've talked about this on the show several times, that the real racism in this country, the real racism, comes from the Democrat Party. You've got Democrat-controlled cities, Chicago. You've got a substandard, basically racist education system that by design does not teach black students and Hispanic students, as well as other school systems across the country, teach everybody. You've got substandard, you've got public housing, substandard public housing. You've got huge welfare for single mothers. So you've got no fathers, no decent education, no decent, you know, an opportunity for people to earn things. And you've got an economy that sucks. Because everything's
regulated,
controlled.
Yeah, it all started with Johnson's design of trying to help, supposedly, help the black community. And this is what we have today. I think this is that's a huge reason why we have what we have today. And I don't think go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just saying my question is, do you think this is by design? Because how else could you create a situation like this where a huge number of young black and Hispanic males are committing an outrageous amount of crimes in liberal Democrat cities? You don't see this in, I don't know, Indianapolis, Charleston, take some cities, you know, Houston. You don't see this in conservative cities, in cities run by Republicans. This is a Democrat problem. This is a liberal. This is a leftist problem. And the question I have is this by design? And this is a rhetorical question, but I believe it is. Go ahead.
Absolutely, I believe, is. Maybe a couple of years ago, a few years ago, I would have thought, I think it's a little conspiracy or, you know, but now I don't put anything past our government, our political systems, people in charge. For instance, why is it that the Democrat Party, hates the thought of school choice and Republicans push for it? Why? Because it's competition. And then you have to perform, and you have to give results in every community, and they don't want that. Why is it that they fight so hard against that? And people really need to wonder when they're voting Democrat, what are you really supporting?
Well, that's what I wonder. Why are they voting Democrat?
No, and I get it, because I come from a huge Democrat area in Los Angeles, Southern California.
I mean, you're supposed to be a liberal. Your prediction. How did this happen?
Exactly. I feel like I went to college and it actually turned me. I didn't know what it was at the time because I wasn't really politically, minded. It is. It was interesting. I had to take this one class, and I don't know if I had told you on previous interviews,
but
I was on the show.
I'm curious now. Yeah.
I had to take. You know, in college, you have to take all of these meaningless electives.
Right.
So I ended up being able to get into this woman's study class or whatever it was. And
this is going to be good.
Well, the teacher, the only thing she did was she just bashed men the whole time. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I think a lot of people in college were, you know, we're all trying to find our ways. You're trying to figure out how to be an adult, yet, you know, what you think, what you agree with very, and this is the thing that's dangerous, though, I always think, with limited life experience, you're trying to make these major life decisions.
Oh, yeah.
18, you know,
19,
you
sure.
You know
the world
after
all about.
One semester. After one semester, you know everything. And to me, it turned me off. And I think the reason why, well, I don't think, the reason why is because, sure, you could be mad at a guy or whatever if you're dating or, you know, you don't have a good, you know, experience. Mm-hmm. But my experience with my family, and I can only go off of what I have experienced in my life, every male in my life was nothing but positive and loving to me. And
that's good.
So
that's
what
wonderful.
What she described was not what I ever experienced. But then as life goes on, I realize that a lot of women don't have those experiences. And so maybe
there's
that's
a lot of
why they relate.
With violence from men.
Yes.
There's a lot of women with just horrible relationships, oppression, control, narcissism, and you name it. It's out there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys too, you know, guys are have violence committed against them by women. They'll never admit it because guys can't talk about that. That's a, there's an issue for you. If you're, you know,
sure.
We'll put this in our, this podcast is going to be an entire list of things, you know, we can get to, but there's a whole world out there. Is staggering. And that's not your experience. My experience is more, you know, just my own family background is much more emotional, self-destruction and, you know, trying to break my spirit. That's what I grew up with. And it probably makes me fearless now. So it's like, you know, trial by fire. So I have a very different outlook that nothing bothers me now. You can't scare me. You know, even with death, you can't.
I mean, it's
going to happen.
Am.
I know that.
Exactly.
Right. So what are you going to do to me now? You know, I mean, I'm already oppressed on social media. We've already got all kinds of other things. But we need to look into this, that why, and here's another thing too, why are blacks and Hispanics singled out for the government racism? You know, why not Asian Americans? Why not Indian Americans or even American Indian Americans?
I'm going to tell you, it's cultural.
Okay, tell me.
It's cultural.
Okay.
Specifically for Hispanic communities, and and there's probably very similar, it's very similar probably to some black communities, but in Hispanic community, a family, I'm going to tell you, their beliefs, whether they know it or not, are usually much more conservative.
Okay. Yeah, I would think so.
But the one thing that I think they prey on with a Hispanic family is the idea of respect. When you grow up in a Hispanic family, respecting elders, respecting authority, respecting anybody older than you, just respecting and listening and paying attention and abiding by what is being told to you with no question. That I think is where they can get a lot of people in the Hispanic culture. To me, I think they prey on that, and it's a very sad thing. I don't know if that's exactly what it is in the black community, because I wasn't raised in a black community and I am not black. But I think there probably might be some similarities, and I think it has to do with the family dynamic and the culture. And so what they do is they don't really look into things. They expect that if you're an authoritative figure and you say this to them, that's what it is. It's a very trusting, loving culture, and I think that's really where it begins when it comes to that.
How about the fatherless rate, Hispanic versus black?
Mm-hmm.
Are there more Hispanic fathers in the homes?
Oh, I would say, you know, I would say yes, more. If you're comparing it to the black community, I would say yes, there are more. But I think even the Hispanic communities are starting to lack in that area. And what ends up happening is, you know, I don't think government aid nowadays is welfare is looked at as embarrassing or maybe possibly a negative connotation as it maybe was a few years ago or years ago.
Right.
I think now it's almost like accepted. And once you come into that mindset and you're okay with that, you pass it on and it becomes a generational way of living. And once I think you're stuck in that cycle, it's a difficult one to get out.
You know, it's interesting. Hispanics have a tradition in this country. We're talking multi-generational, long-term experience. The military, I think there's there's an over, if I can say, by quota representation of Hispanic Americans in the military, you know, and there's a split in this country that I think is fascinating. I talk about this with Josie Cossi, who does the Latino Report. You should call her sometime. That would be interesting to get you two together. She's from Nicaragua. I mean, she grew up under communism.
Okay.
So she's the real article, and she's on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock Central. So that'd be like six. No, you're Colorado. Are you Mountain Time? So it'd be like 7 o'clock.
Here. I am Mountain Time.
Okay, good. So
the one
West
person
Coast
in the country that's Mountain Time. Nobody lives
exactly,
in that.
Exactly, yeah. Well, and we talked about it. I'm really glad. Yeah, it's glad to hear. I talked about this with Josie several times, that the Republican Party has this ridiculous belief that all American Hispanics or Latinos believe that illegal immigration is a good thing. That illegal aliens are wonderful because they're Hispanic. So therefore, as one voting, you know, unanimous block, that the Republican Party could not be against illegal aliens because they would alienate their Hispanic American voters. This is ridiculous. There's one group in this country that doesn't want illegal aliens. It's long-term Hispanic American multi-generational families, right?
It is. It's very much the opposite. And when they, and you're saying it, you're using the, illegal aliens or illegal immigration. But when it's on mainstream media, if you notice it, they'll say Republicans or conservatives are against immigration. They don't like immigrants. We're all from immigrants. So that's just silly.
I am an immigrant. I was born in Canada. I got off the boat in New York from Australia. I am an immigrant.
What they leave out is the illegal. Yeah. That is what people are against. And it's not the fact that you question. I feel for the people at the border. If I was in their situation, I'd probably want to do the same thing and take advantage of it, right? So you can't really blame them necessarily, especially when they're being welcomed. So it has to be put on the government and the government in control at that time. Because obviously, whether you supported Trump, don't support him, like him, don't like him, that border was tight when he was in office. And there's no question about that.
Yeah, there's a globalist aspect to this too. So let's get back to the cash bail. This is a very individual small issue that I think completely relates to an overall problem, that if you want to destroy the United States, one of the best ways to do it is to promote crime, shoplifting. We've got looters, that are going in 50 to 100 at a time, raiding entire stores. I think Target
But that's going to be considered, and I don't mean to cut you off, but in Illinois, that's going to be considered nonviolent.
Oh, really? Right? Don't worry about cutting me off. I do that constantly. So just jump right in. It's okay. It's perfectly acceptable right here. Yeah. So tell me.
How is that nonviolent?
Really?
Because there's nobody. It's a crime against an object, a car theft. Nonviolent. Even though it affects somebody's life and they can't make a living, it's nonviolent. So that's another thing that in crime we have to take into consideration. What is considered nonviolent? Yeah, you didn't beat the person up, but financially you wrecked them.
Car. How many people spend years paying off their cars?
Mm-hmm.
You've taken years from that person. You have stolen all the labor that went into buying that car and having them use that car.
And that is their way to make a living and to, provide for themselves and to survive. Yet
but that's
it's a
violent.
Nonviolent offense.
Yeah,
it's
well,
nonviolent
that's violent.
Because, So anyways, I just wanted to reiterate that.
No, that's fine. But cash bail. So how does it benefit the average citizen to have criminals not have to have a bail system? We'll get into what bail actually is. I want to make sure we cover that too. But what's the propaganda line they're giving? That they're saying that this will benefit the average citizen. How?
Because if you are arrested, this is what they're going to sell. And this is what they have sold to people. If you are arrested for not paying a parking ticket, do you want to be stuck in jail because you can't afford the high bail that they put on your freedom? Okay. That's another thing. The majority of people who are sitting in jail did not forget to pay a parking ticket. You know what I mean?
How about that?
But they want people they want people to believe that. It is
they want white
silly.
People to believe
it
that.
Is absolutely
now, let's be honest. They want white people to believe that because it's the white person that's going to worry about not paying a parking ticket. It's the middle class, working white dude or dudette, who's who's going to worry about the little things. Oh no, I forgot to pay my parking ticket. I can't believe I double parked. It's terrible.
And I'm not saying that it's not true. I'm not saying that it's not true.
This is
if you don't pay a parking ticket, you can have a warrant put out for your arrest and you can get arrested and they will put a bail. But I'm going to tell you, that is the minority
of course it
arrests.
Is.
Do you think police are
like
out there looking for people with bench warrants? It's just silly.
Exactly. I remember the argument in California against school choice was that witches might be teaching kids. We can't have that. So we have to have everybody in the government.
Yeah.
That's what they said.
Yep.
I said, really? That's your concern? All right. Let's talk about what bail is. I don't know how much legal stuff you look into. And we can always ask Jonathan. He'll be here in about 15 minutes. But can you explain to folks what bail is and why we have it? Feel free.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you the reason why I'm very well versed in bail is because I married into a bail bonding company. I mean, a family.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, family.
Maybe they'll sponsor my show.
For many, many years, 30-something years. So I'm very, very well versed on how
Let's bring
him
on the show.
Works.
No, I'm serious. This is interesting. I'd love to have your family, you know, bring your husband on. Let's bring him on as a guest sometime.
Sure.
This would be interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Have you interviewed him on the air? Oh, wouldn't that be fun? Anyway.
So, yeah, right.
So tell me.
That would
about
be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've worked with it. I've seen all aspects of it. And the continuous fight to keep it in, to keep bail bondsmen in the loop, not put them out of business here in Colorado, because it seems like every couple of years they're trying to, you know, vote them out, because I think eventually Colorado does want to get to a no cash bail, be a no cash bail state. But as of right now, there are bondsmen. So that is their, that's their, you know, attack right now. But what bail is, let's say you get arrested for whatever the situation is, you get arrested. And, or a person gets arrested, let's say, because they were called because somebody thought that they, you know, stole something. Okay. So the person will get picked up and the person will probably say, no, I didn't do it. The police will say, well, okay, well, we're going to arrest you. They put them in jail. And they will say, they will, what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to look and see the person's past criminal history. If you have a past criminal history of similar offenses, or if you just have years and years of doing just a bunch of crimes, then your bail will be set higher than the average person who this is their first offense. Okay. So let's say this person, it was their first offense. They say, okay, your bail will be $5,000. Okay. So what that person can do in Colorado is they can say, all right, I'm going to call my mom or my family member or friend, and we're going to pay the $5,000 directly to the courts and get me out. Most people don't have $5,000 just sitting around at any one time, especially right now in today's economy. So what they'll do is they'll have their loved one, a bail bondsman, and the bail bondsmen here in Colorado are very, very heavily regulated by the insurance company, by the insurance department. So the most they can charge is 15% and the least is 10. So it's not like they can just go and charge you whatever they want. It's they're regulated. So that bondsman can say, we're going to charge you $500, or they can say $750. It just kind of depends on how that bondsman sees the person, what's their cosigner like, does that person have, like, you know, offenses? Is that person tied to Colorado? Do they live somewhere else? They take into a
Flight
bunch
risk.
Of different aspects.
Flight risk,
yeah.
Right? Okay.
And so basically they it's called underwriting. So they kind of put it all together and they calculate it and they figure out, okay, we're going to take a chance on you. And lots of times what happens is a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, a family member, or a close friend, husband, wife, will say, okay, let's get this person out. I'll pay the $500 or, you know, whatever, $750 to get them out. I promise that if I'm going to sign this contract with the bail bondsman, that if they do not appear at their court dates, I will pay you the $5,000, the bondsman, because the bondsman will then have to take that $5,000 and pay it to the courts within 90 days of that person not appearing.
Okay. This is getting interesting. Yeah.
But when you get into it, but when you get into it between the courts and the bondsmen, that's the only contract that the courts acknowledge. They have nothing to do with the cosigner. They have nothing to do with the person who you did get out of jail. Their contract is only with the bail bondsman. So when those people skip, because the bail bondsman does not want to have to pay that money, first off, you don't usually want to pay that kind of money ever. And so in order to not, you have to go bounty that person.
Bounty hunters. That was on my list of questions as soon as you started talking about this. I got to find out about bounty hunters. What are those?
Yes. And my husband and the family, they do their own bounty hunting. So basically they go look for this person. They have intel. They try to figure it out. Lots of times, a lot of people will, the person who has to pay the $5,000, like the mom, the dad, whoever signed, will say, oh, they're over here. they're here. They'll usually tell you because they don't want to have to pay the $5,000.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. They don't want they're interested to turn in their fellow
exactly.
family members.
So everybody works together because they have a dog in the fight, right?
Speaking of dog, the bounty hunter. great segue.
Well, and so when they get this person, the bondsman only has 90 days to get that person in front of the judge in order mm-hmm. for that bond to be off the records. I'm like, okay, you turned your person in. You don't owe us the $5,000.
So the bail is done.
The bondsman
if
says,
the person shows
yeah.
up, right? So the there is no bail. There's nothing to be paid. Everybody's happy. Well, except the bail bond. So I guess they lose their interest. Or I don't know. Well, how does that work? How do the bail folks get paid? Bail bond people get paid if the person
shows
up?
So they make that $500 originally.
Oh, for making the contract?
$750, whatever they charge, because
right.
that's non-refundable. Okay. But it's because the person didn't have to pay the $5,000. They only paid a percentage.
Okay.
So that's how they make their money. But mm-hmm. what happens with the bail bondsman is people say, oh, you know, they rip people off. They do this and that. Da, 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 da. Well, a bail bondsman cannot stay in business, at least in Colorado, if you have a bunch of skips. Because the courts are going to say, once you can't bring somebody back to the courts, you go on a basically a blacklist. And until you get that paid or that person's in front of the jail, you cannot continue business.
Oh, that's interesting. So the bail people are responsible. Yeah. So what about law enforcement? If someone's skipping bail, I guess, as they say, mm-hmm. or they're skipping the court date, that becomes a law enforcement matter. Are they leaving it to the bail bond companies to find these people? I mean, why aren't the police looking for them?
Oh, you mean when the person who, like, let's say the person that my husband bailed out, they skipped. Why aren't the police
right.
looking for them?
Yeah.
Okay, if it's a big enough charge, they sometimes do, like if it's, you know, first degree murder or something very, very large,
right.
then sure, they will probably have them out looking for them. But if it's not something that big, and especially right now,
nonviolent,
with the way law enforcement is,
especially
now with law enforcement, you know, uh-huh. they're so, they really don't want to do more than they have to do. Because do you blame them with all of the, you know, a bunch of them, you know, being going to jail or going, you know, having, losing their jobs because they're supposedly a racist or, you know, whatever the situation is. So a lot of them are just doing the bare minimum just until they can get that retirement. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do. I've met government employees. I used to be one at various times. And the only things they care about are sick leave, vacations, and retirement. That's it. That's all they talk about. It's really sad.
And then you add more to their plate, and it's like, God, they're going to go out and maybe give a few tickets and do what they are asked to do, but they're not going to go above and beyond and try to be heroes anymore, you know? So sometimes they do, but it is not their job as much as it is the bail bondsman job. And they are given the authority to bounty that person because as a certified bondsman, you're allowed to go after the person you've bailed out. And if they skipped on you, you have that authority to do that. Now, of course, you can't be violent about it and you can't, you know, but
it's a strange role because they're actually acting, they're actually enforcing laws. They're enforcing court orders. They're enforcing, so bail bonds companies and bounty hunters are actually, you know, a non-sworn law enforcement aid. They're actually helping. So by getting rid of cash bail and getting rid of bail bondsmen and getting rid of bounty hunters, mm-hmm. you're actually hurting law enforcement against the average citizen. Go ahead.
Exactly. So you're putting more on the law enforcement's plate, first off, because they're the ones who are going to have to go look for these people who were let out for free, who aren't going to return, who commit more crimes. And lots of times with bail bondsmen, what you do is a person who you bailed out could go a year. They have to make it on that bond. They have to make every court appearance. They can't skip one court appearance.
It seems to fit in the puzzle of creating more crime to create more fear, to create more draconian policies to promote more gun, you know, theft and confiscation by the government. It's all part of the Marxian world government plan that I've always believed that the criminal element, government uses criminals to scare honest people into giving up their rights. This is just a part of that overall plan. We'll talk about that, then I'll bring
it
up Bianca. I'm sure he's got a couple of questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And so, you know, the reality is that if you look at it, because I used to think, yeah, what is the purpose of a bail bondsman? What is the purpose of this? But it's also a third party who the only dog they have in it is a financial, is basically contractual. They don't want to have to pay the money. So now what you're doing when you're doing cash bail, no cash bail, or your jailer is your bail bondsman. There's a conflict of interest there. Then why aren't they going to go out and just start arresting people for silly things? Because they want to make money. They're going to say, right, you can either pay us because we're going to get rid of the bail bonds or the bondsman. And that's what they're doing right now in Colorado, is the jails will act as a bondsman and say, you can either call a bail bondsman and pay them, you know, $500, or you can pay us $200. Well, they're going to pay the jail $200. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so, and that money goes to the jail. So why there's such a conflict of interest there on top of such a community, you know, hazard that's taking place also when you don't have checks and balances and nobody's keeping track of people who are being let out on crimes.
Yeah, but we've lost the original purpose of bail, which, as I understand it, at our founding, was that before bail, people were incarcerated and they were put in jail immediately as soon as they're charged with a crime, and they had no ability to get a defense for themselves. So the whole purpose of bail is it holds you accountable to come back to court, but you're out on bail, as they say, so you can, you know, contact your lawyers and prepare a defense and get ready for your trial. That's originally what it was for. And that's
and if you have a job, you
locked.
Can still continue your job.
Yeah.
You don't lose your job. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, John, you're a little bit early. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Finish.
And that's a lot of times because people will get arrested and their main focus is, okay, I can fight this when I'm out, but I need to get to work so I can make money. Yeah. I have a family. I have this or that. You know, so it's to keep everything in order and not let everything fall apart, because what does that person do? Then that person has to go and work the streets or do something on the side to make money. Or they have, you know, it just
maybe commit a crime to make money.
Yeah,
Because they can't, they're not on bail.
Exactly.
Yeah. I promised to get Pianchi in. Let me get him for the question. And then Jonathan, who does our legal report, is on. If you have a couple extra minutes to stick around, that'd be great. I don't know if you have to leave exactly at the top of the hour, but if you got just about 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes maybe afterwards, I want to bring in Jonathan. So, Jonathan, we're talking about the cash bail law in Illinois with Jessica Rivera, who is our new Monday investigative reporter, political correspondent, and anything else you want to put into your title. Pianchi, I want to get you in here just before the end. I'm sure you have a question for Jessica.
Well, the cash bail law is coming about through these suggestions by these activists like BLM. And government is not the problem of the crime wave in Chicago, and then again it is, because at your highest level of government, you have black faces. The lieutenant governor, female, she's black. You got the secretary of state, he's black. You got the Chicago DOJ, he's black. Your prosecutor for Cook County, she's black. You had a black mayor. Whatever that problem is, the problem exists. And the problem, and you can't say it's blacks because you got Africans in this country. Make mention of Nigerians, first, second, third, fourth generation. They don't end up in these crime data.
Mm-hmm.
Those are black Americans. And Hispanics is about a tenth of the murder rate than the black Americans. And it's not all black Americans. It's a certain percentage that's causing all these issues. And it needs to be told like that. It's always not, it's never told the way it is. That's where people who's not totally aware, they hear about it, don't get a clear picture.
Jessica?
Yeah, no, I think he's 100%. I think that exactly. A lot of that information that he just said, which is 100% correct and true, would never, ever be allowed to be said probably on mainstream media, because it would be, you are, you know, you're basically pinning everything on the Black community. And that's not what it is. What it is saying, this is the reality. Now let's try and fix it. But let's fix it by not losing more lives to crime. Let's fix it by, for instance, what I had told you earlier, Greg. Maybe let's start with school choice. Let's start getting those, you know, in these communities. And in some of the Hispanic communities, too, and some of the, you know, poor white communities. School, let's get school choice in there so that these kids don't grow up to think that they don't have an opportunity to go out and make something of themselves, that they have to stay in these communities and just do what they see. And what
yes.
they have
see,
seen
you know,
for, go ahead.
You
Jackie,
know what another problem
Jonathan.
Is? You got a population of Blacks that want to have a separate Black nation in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you talk about school choice, you got teachers unions, teachers that's making money off the fact that these kids show up at the building, whether they learn or not, because that's how the pay goes. You, yeah. I've even argued with judges that's on the ballot for circuit court and for appellate court, and they are against school choice. You can see the correlation, the relationship here. So yes, you need school choice so that where you have children that come from functional parents can separate their kids from that other environment, because mm-hmm. they never will learn. You just sacrificing one kid after the other. So you're absolutely
yeah.
right. That's something that's a contention for a long time.
You two are going to have some great chats. I have a feeling this is going to be an interesting thing as you both get to know each other. I'm going to bring Jonathan and make his line live too. I think you know a separate Black nation to me just doesn't work in this country, because if we start separating, then they win. But what I would like to see is a separate educational system. I would like to see the government completely out of it. I would abolish all government education, especially at the federal level, because it's not in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It is illegal for the federal government to have anything to do with things that aren't specifically delegated to them. That's what the 10th Amendment's all about. So mm-hmm. the fact that we have a Department of Education is blatantly unconstitutional. But we got Jonathan here. I'm going to get to his theme a little bit. He's been up for a while, so he gets a theme. But Jonathan, are you familiar with this cash bail law in Illinois? And I want to introduce you to Jessica Rivera, who's going to be preceding you on the show here. So Jonathan, what do you think? Go ahead.
Nice to meet you. The reason, of course, I'm calling in early is because you always ask me about what you were just talking about over the
yeah,
break.
You do. Into these firestorms because the show's
I figured I'd call in early just so I'd be ready for the firestorm. But it's not because you know I want to take your time. But I'm familiar with the general problem. I haven't studied the exact details. Of course, I believe that. Well, I mean, ultimately, when we talk about these things legally and legal reform proposals, we're always talking about like a perfect world versus what is, what we want it to be. You know, in a perfect world, it would be good if someone, you know, regardless of their bail status awaiting a trial, if they got appropriately slammed at the trial and held accountable for their crimes, it wouldn't be such a big deal. But of course, that's not happening either, as far as I can tell. So, but I mean, there's no question that that we've got Mad Max after Thunderdome here, where people think that they can just do whatever, you know, that there's no concept of obeying the law, because they know they can get away with it, and they can. So I think it's not only extremely dangerous; it is a complete destruction of one of the core purposes of having a government.
hmm.
I mean, you know what a Cloward Piven strategy to overwhelm the government, they talk about financially, but it's another thing. They want the system to collapse so they can reconstruct it as a socialist utopia.
Yeah, I want to.
They're
just
doing a really good job of
here.
It because.
All right, Jessica, do you have time to stick around for a while? Because I'd love to have you stick around for as much of this hour as you can. Or do you have to go? I just want to make sure we get that in.
So because
you got some time?
Because I have a kindergartner, I got to get him going. But I promise that I will make the time next week. I'll try to extend some of the time.
Oh, you don't have
on
to.
Mondays.
I'm just glad to get you for an hour. But if there's any contact information or websites or anything you want to conclude with. And now I'm going to get on a Cloward Piven. I'm curious about that. But catch the podcast. And if you have follow-up questions or things like that, feel free to get them in. But this has been a great hour. This first hour has been fabulous. So I'm really looking forward to our future Mondays. Yeah.
Okay. Same here.
Dash? All right.
Talk to you later.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, Jessica. Take care.
Yeah.
I had a feeling all right. I had a feeling she might have to take off at this point. Jonathan, if you want to call in a little earlier too, this is going to be a great extension to our report. So let's get your theme. Let's get back on the Cloward Piven and let's talk about all the things that you want to talk about and we'll be right back. What is the law? Are we under the rule of law? Does that mean those who make the laws rule us? Aren't we under the consent of we the people, where we write the laws we consent to be governed by and rule the government? Who is the law? Is it the Supreme Court, the President, the Congress, the states? Can you take the law into your own hands? Is there any time the law isn't in your own hands? In a country under a coup d'etat and a stolen government, there is no law, but there are a whole bunch of things being done in the name of law. And now, with this state of confusion and contradiction, let's try to find a way out together by using the law. Because if our government of the people, by the people, and for the people means anything, it means we the people are the law. And now to try and make some sense of all this and use the law as it was meant to be used, to find our way back to freedom, it's time now for The Legal Report with Jonathan Mosley. Yes, I'll tell you, Jessica's going to be a huge addition to the show here. She's got a ton of broadcast experience, journalism experience, political correspondent experience, and it's just, this is, and so we're going to be able to explore some issues in great detail. So this is going to be fun. And then you get to handle the legal end of it. Which is also great. You want to follow up on the cash bail or the Cloward Piven? My contention was that this is all by design, that the left, the Marxists, the communists, are using criminals to destroy this country and make the honest people fearful so much so that they'll give up their rights and that the communists can move in and say, well, we'll take care of you. Yeah, no big deal. And cash bail is just part of that, or getting rid of cash bail. What do you think?
Yeah. No, I mean... The thing is, the clout, and these are all huge topics, including your opening intro there. I mean, like, we have topics, and then you give this opening that, like, invites a huge conference on what is the meaning of the law. And I'm like, oh, my God.
We're just bit by bit, Jonathan, week by week. We'll get to it.
Let me just say real quickly that I think that the valid, because people talk about the state of nature where, there is no government, everyone's just on their best behavior. But of course people don't live up to their best behavior. And that would mean the law means protecting, or stopping people in the exercise of their own freedom from actually hurting other people. So the law might be, a communal effort to make sure that, your right to swing your fist ends where my nose begins. Mm-hmm. However, probably 99.9% of what our societies consider the law has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the rulers having us behave the way they think we should behave or what they think we should do. It's not about protecting anybody, you know, protecting person A from person B. It's about the rulers imposing their view of, you know, of the way things ought to be upon the rest of us. So it's a huge question about, you know, what is law? You could go on for weeks in a, you know, faculty seminar.
Well, that's just kind of get us in the mood for talking. We don't have to take the theme and analyze it, but it,
the,
really that's
the
my big overall.
Cloward,
that's the yeah.
Okay,
go ahead.
But the idea with the Cloward-Piven strategy is that they proposed it. You know, we have to be careful. A lot of times that there are labels for groups that are not things they call themselves. Like, for example, neocons. Originally, that was a slur against the neocons, you know, these young whippersnappers who don't know anything about conservatism. And they're, you know, they're all, and so, well, so they came, yeah. You know, they hit back with the term paleocon. You know, they attack.
Well, neo is new, right? Doesn't neo mean new? Is it Latin or where does it come from?
And paleo means like, you know, dinosaurs or something, or the Paleolithic period.
Paleo, I know what that means, yeah.
So we have two terms which were launched as insults upon the other. They're not being used by them. They're not things that people call themselves, although eventually it becomes so widespread that the neocons embrace the term or don't know the difference. But we can't think too much about groups or movements, things like that from the label when they didn't pick the label for themselves. Cloward-Piven, however, is not other people critiquing what's going on. It was openly avowed by Cloward and Piven.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Cloward and Francis Fox Piven, they proposed it, and they're completely open about what they're, you know, what they're planning to do. I mean, it was their strategy. It's not somebody else, you know, trying to impose our interpretation on what the left is doing. It was the openly proclaimed goal of these professors that, you know, that the United States will never accept socialism unless unless the system collapses. And, you know, it goes back to Henry Mann, you know, and again, I belong to a church that was tuned in to a lot of Christian scholarship of America, and they were very scholarly, the Red Books, I'm just not good with names. And they would go back to a lot of these original sources of socialists at a time in the 1930s when socialism was the new fad. It's like today, you know, we laugh at bell bottoms. There was a time when bell bottoms were cool.
They're
you know,
coming back. It's kind of ironic, but you know, anyway,
probably,
yeah.
But I mean, I'm just saying that there are things that. You have to understand that at the time that people were running around doing these things, it was new and fresh, and it was the latest fad, and it was cool.
Right, right.
And socialists were very open about their goals because they were writing 100 years ago when socialism was the bright new, you know, shiny toy of the intellectual elite who actually don't know anything. And, you know, they're elite. They're elites only in their own minds, of course, you know, they're actually morons. But the thing is that we have to understand that Cloward-Piven strategy is in their own words. The goal was to overload and break the welfare system, have chaos ensue, take control in the chaos, implement socialism and communism through government force.
Right.
It's basically the Reichstag fire.
Yeah, wasn't it the overload welfare and make government so expensive that the economy collapses, the government collapses? But the whole premise is wrong, though, because, you know, if everything collapses, to replace it with a totalitarian system, what if people reject the totalitarian system? I said, no, that's not the way. We want our freedom back. That was the solution. You took our freedom. Then the system collapsed. and we want to go back to our freedom. Excuse me.
Well, the Cloward Pullivan strategy is a reaction to the fact that the American people do reject socialism and communism.
Okay.
It's the fact. I mean, way back 100 years ago, the socialists were writing in education reform, which is when, you know, they wanted to have everybody have a common education, not universal access to education. They had to be educated the same way.
The same way. And, that's Horace Mann and the what's that? The Prussian model that we've talked about on the show before. Right.
And he's just the most notable, the most famous out of a whole movement. But the whole movement was based on the idea that and like I say, they say it's not me saying it. It's not critics saying it. It's like they're saying it in their own words.
Oh, yeah.
Because they thought, well, socialism is wonderful. You know, it's great. And so they write things that today they would never dream of putting on paper. But, you know, just like communism, you know, before Stalin, the Soviet Union was this wonderful new experiment and everything like that. There was a statue in Red Square. I've seen it, of an American revolutionary. Mm. He was over there, helped the Russian Revolution. You know,
John Reed?
You know,
was that John Reed?
What?
Was that John Reed?
I don't know. I don't remember. I'm not so great with names.
Well, he was the movie Reds with Warren Beatty, and that's exactly what they were talking about. Was the Americans that helped help Lenin? I think his name was John Reed. Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
But then when Stalin came along and was a monster, now suddenly nobody wants to, you know, everyone's running the other way and burning their papers and trying to erase any evidence that they've had. I'm talking metaphorically, that you know that they have had anything to do with communism or the Soviet Union, and you know, and that's why, as Dinesh D'Souza documented so clearly, and when I say Dinesh D'Souza, I mean him orchestrating experts come on and get many experts documenting this in his past documentaries, that's when suddenly communism had to be redefined. At least fascism had to be redefined as right wing, which is clearly absurd, because right wing is about small government, limited government, limited scope, individual rights, small government spending. I mean, there you could not think of a more opposite of you know, Nazism or fascism or anything like that. So it's a complete lie to try to hide from the historical evidence that socialism and communism and fascism and all these totalitarian movements of the left are not just wrong, are not just unacceptable, but horrific. And so the whole thing's a big lie.
No, this is a fascination for me, because I've always wondered where this came from, that the left suddenly, you know, tried to convince people that Stalin was left wing and Hitler was right wing. No, they're not. It's just left wing on left wing violence. It's the communists versus the Nazis. You know, and the fascists were the Italian version.
Those who study the revolutionary left in detail historically, you know, in historical detail, have always said that there's no more vicious hatred between groups and outright violence than between between leftist movements trying to occupy the same space.
Charlottesville.
So, you know,
that's what Charlottesville was violent. You had two leftist groups. Charlottesville. And they always try to blame that on Trump supporters.
Right.
And so you had two leftist groups that met at Charlottesville. That's where the violence came from.
It was a cattle call. There were lots of different groups, but yes, so the fact that say Hitler and Stalin were at different points in time. I mean, they eventually, you know, joined forces to invade Poland and start World War II. But the idea that they were antagonistic in simplistic minds means they must have opposite beliefs. And the historical truth is the opposite is true. It's because they are so much alike that they can't both exist. One of them has to die out. You know, so they're fighting for the same space but it's the big lie, of course. But what I was trying to get to was that, because I was in the education department for 5 years, and I was with groups that studied this stuff very extensively, including Phyllis Schlafly's group that my mom belonged to, Eagle Forum. And the socialists were quite open about the fact that the American people would never accept socialism. We had, meaning the education reformers, the deformers, not the teachers of 100 years ago, but the parasites trying to destroy education policy and everything like that. They openly discussed in writing that they had to dumb down the American people before they would ever accept socialism. The only
right.
they had to use the schools, and this has been going on for 100 years, at least. That they had to indoctrinate and dumbify the American school children if there was any hope of getting socialism here in the United States. And despite all their efforts in indoctrination and how they have poisoned their children, they still haven't mm-hmm. been able to pull it off. Cloward and Piven, they came up with this strategy, which is a reaction to the fact that they had failed to get the American people to accept socialism, thrashing about how can we get this socialist utopia where everybody dies and people starve, and it's just wonderful, you know, it's just a wonderful utopia.
Oh, yeah. Can't wait.
To get to this, you know, where the ends justify the means at all costs, they came up with this idea, well, we have to crash the system.
Okay.
And, you know, but that's a reaction to their utter failure to convince the American people that the American people really want to be socialists, but they just don't know it yet.
Well, here's a question, too. Have they dumbed down the mm-hmm. teachers? I mean, are they purposely recruiting dumbed down teachers to create dumbed down kids?
Oh, of course.
Okay.
They took over the teacher training. There are teacher training institutions. You know, there are faculties or departments and standalone things that train teachers. And so they have invaded, like, you know, an invasive species, like a foreign invader parasite into American nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have thoroughly corrupted the training of teachers.
Because you have to have an education degree to teach in the elementary and the high schools and the junior highs, but in college you have to have a degree in your field. So college is different. They don't require an education degree to teach in college. It's
only
the lower grades.
But if you want to go into, what's legally required as a license,
mm-hmm.
and what is going to help you get a job are two different things.
Okay.
So if you're going to try to get a job as a professor in a college, you may not mm-hmm. be legally required that you have this or that license, but you're gonna want to show more to compete for that job.
Okay.
And of course, in the 60s and early 70s, the whack jobs that drove sane people to the Republican Party, having nothing to do with race. They were burning down and protesting and doing sit-ins against the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Then they became the faculty,
mm-hmm.
and now they're only going to hire other lunatics like them in the colleges. So if you would be a stellar candidate 100 years ago, you're not eligible because you're not a communist. Sympathize.
It's educational inbreeding is what it is. And we know what that results in. Yeah. Interesting.
Right. Okay. And so now there are those who have the theory, which may be explanatory, but it's not really hard. It's not the hard facts that professions like teachers always suffer from, an inferiority complex, that they're not as that their profession is perceived as being too easy. So they're always falling for the latest fads that try to upgrade their clout and self-importance and things like that, like new math and you know, all these kind of, you know, they always
I had that in school.
It's not enough for them to just to teach. They have to upgrade it to some higher level of sophistication, and in the process they keep falling for all these goofy fads. Like the idea that, for example, that teachers are going to be psychiatrists for their children. You know, the teachers are like, well, what am I supposed to do if a child comes to me and asks me about my sexuality? Well, why the hell would they be doing that?
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, they're supposed to be telling, you know, they should be asking you about, you know, about the history lesson. I mean, what the hell?
What ask a teacher about that.
I mean, who does that?
Never came up.
And if it did, the teacher should say, you know what? I'm not licensed as a psychiatrist. I'm going to go to jail if I pretend to be a psychiatrist without a license.
Yeah.
If I put out a shingle saying, you know, John Mosley, psychiatric help, and they come to you and say, John, do you have a license for that? No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, could you turn around and you know, put your hands behind your back. And I know, you know, the thing is, I know people like in the construction industry who have been prosecuted for not having a license. You know, so yes,
Brandon doesn't have a license. He was never elected. Why didn't we get him out of the White House? He's practicing, you know, being a president with a, you know, without the credentials. Just a side.
Well, shall we transition to the fun point of the?
Yes.
So I was trying to find this out. So the Libertarian Party, and I've always respected the Libertarian Party, but you know, they kind of love to fight amongst themselves, and you know, they're so determined to the idea that nobody should have, you know, power over anybody, that I can only imagine what a Libertarian chapter meeting is like. So they don't necessarily, you know, for them to actually do something is, I'm very surprised, but they are suing, to have Mitch McConnell and Brandon, appointed, they say conservatorship, but I'm not sure that's the right
guardianship term, maybe. I think it's probably something who's that singer? The Britney Spears. Remember when
Britney Spears, exactly right.
Yeah, it was a guardianship. Okay.
So now a conservatorship is different, and it's harder to get a guardianship than a conservatorship. And I think that one, I believe that Britney Spears is...
What are you doing in the background? You got it.
I'm making coffee.
Well, I can hear everything. It's hysterical. Anyway, go. And Pianchi had a point. We'll get back to him. Sure.
I have a phone that's designed to pick up everything except me. It picks up everything else that it shouldn't. A good microphone, and I did this for my church. Should be focused. It should have a cone. Of sensitivity that would,
mine does.
Would emphasize.
My Yeti blue mic that I use on the show. Yeah.
Mine does the reverse.
Oh, okay.
So Britney Spears, I believe, had a conservatorship.
Oh, okay.
But her father would like control the money over things that weren't just about money. He would like, you know, say, I'm going to cut you off if you, I don't know, if you don't use birth control or something.
Yeah.
Some really intrusive
thing.
Do a
concert.
Like that.
Enjoy yourself. Yeah. Have fun. Yeah.
I don't know. So the thing is, a conservatorship technically is just about somebody who can't handle their money, but it is not controlling their life.
That's a guardianship.
You know,
right?
It gives the conservator power over their financial affairs and decisions and their property, but not over their body and their health or their life. A guardian is for somebody who is completely unable to handle anything.
That would be
easier to get a,
Yeah.
Well, yes, it's easier to get a conservatorship. However, I think the guardian is a more accurate fit, mm-hmm. even though it's harder to do. Now, the thing is, I couldn't find out when the Libertarian Party has actually filed, because in one place they say that they're looking for a D.C. probate attorney to help them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not clear if they're just floating the idea or if they've actually filed something. And the other thing is that, of course, obviously, it this situation isn't exactly what it isn't exactly, you know, fit anything that's ever been done before. But they
well,
they,
we do that all the time.
Argue.
That's no problem. We're used to that.
Right. But they first of all, I think that they're trying to do it in the District of Columbia probate court, which is where these things should be done for somebody in D.C. I question that because I think while these two dinosaurs work in D.C., they maintain, you know, their home is in Kentucky for Mitch McConnell, and I think they should add Dianne Feinstein in California.
Right.
And Joe Biden in Delaware. Now, of course, no Delaware court, anyone who's a Biden or connected to the Biden, this is automatically, you know, the court, you know, the judge is required to like bow down and scrape and whip themselves and right. give the Bidens whatever they want. So I don't really think that a Delaware court is going to be very receptive, but and of course, you know, everybody's asking like, are you just doing this as a stunt? And it's like, you know, oh no, I'm not doing it as a stunt. Oh no. But as long as there's valid grounds for something, and if it makes a point, you can't do something in the court that has no valid basis for it.
Hmm.
But, you know, if 90% of the outcome is, I mean, the thing is it a stunt? Well, could it potentially work? Yeah, it could possibly work. So it's a valid lawsuit, but you know, the chances, I mean, the reasons why it's not going to work have nothing to do with the law. They have to do with the fact that our systems are corrupt. So asking somebody to do what they ought to do, knowing that they're not going to do what they ought to do, is the failing of the system, not the failing, not that you're doing something improperly as a stunt. But yes, it's a stunt to some extent. So if they brought it in Delaware, then and you know it's inevitably going to be thrown out for non-legal reasons, for political reasons. Well, you know, you still get your bite at the, you know, you still get your day in the sun. So I don't think they should do it in D.C. because the people are not citizens of D.C. They still vote in their home states. I think they should add Dianne Feinstein. I think now the thing is that they have made the argument about the fact that they are harmed by this problem, and they could probably find other people who have stronger claims to having been individually harmed. For example, the January 6th people who are in jail because, you know, because Joe Biden, you know, just believes this nonsense. And has made speeches. Joe Biden is not just, I mean, he's saying, well, that sounds far-fetched. No, he's gone up there, you know, he has condemned them from the podium as president and given marching orders to his government. But so they argue that they're different from just any average person in asking for, you know, so suppose a total stranger came along and wanted to have a guardian appointed for me. And, you know, the natural question would be, well, who are you? But, you know, if somebody said, well, look, you like ran into me in a car accident and you totaled my car and you obviously don't have a clue, you know, what you're doing, you know, where you are, then they might have a case. So, So, no, but I think it's hysterical. But the thing is, I mean, you know, like I think I mentioned, and my father was one of the most wonderful people, you know, wonderful men who's ever lived. But at his end, with dementia and things, whatever it was, I mean, there's a whole family of similar issues. He loved war movies, and he was in mm-hmm. the Korean War. He just probably seen every war movie 100 times. And so my sister put on, Midway. And he was just panicky. He was terrible because the pictures of the airplanes strafing
right.
the base or whatever, he couldn't tell that it wasn't real.
Now,
he
thought it was
movie
under attack, yeah.
Times.
Yeah, didn't matter.
These are movies he'd seen 1,000 times. He could, you know, he could tell you by memory when he was mm-hmm. when he was well. But by the time he was going downhill, you know, he wanted everyone to get down in the basement. Now, she didn't have a basement.
Yeah.
And the planes weren't, you know, it was a movie. So my point is, what makes you think Joe Biden isn't going to get up tomorrow morning and suddenly decide we need to launch nuclear missiles at, say, you know, Germany or, you know, Brazil or some crazy thing? Much less Russia. I mean, someone in his deteriorating condition, we can just stand back from a distance and say, "Oh, isn't that too bad?" No, he could get us into a war because mm-hmm. he can't tell the difference between fantasy and reality.
Well, that's why he's the perfect person for the folks that are actually running the government. You know, I was going to one of the things I want to talk to Jessica about is investigating Obama's role in COVID. And the mandates and the policies and the lockdowns and everything else that happened. That's never really been explored. But there's a meme that's going around of Harris and Biden on puppet strings, and they're held by Obama, whose puppet strings are held by Soros. You know, it makes me wonder whose Soros' puppet strings are held by. But the thing is, he's the perfect person. This is why Democrats want him, because he will say whatever the people behind the scenes can't say. Because they could be held accountable, but he can't be held accountable because we know he doesn't know what he's saying, and therefore it's okay, even though what he's saying is horrible. It's this weird contradiction that people are making allowances for someone that couldn't be there, shouldn't be there. And where's the 25th Amendment? You know, why do we need? How come the Libertarian Party isn't pushing for that? Because that would actually remove right now.
But the thing is that the 25th Amendment cannot be invoked by someone outside of government. It has to be done by Congress. No, it has to be invoked by, well, let me check it, I should say. But it's most commonly by the vice president together with the...
Well, that's not happening.
Right.
Unless it was Mike Pence. Mike Pence would have done it to Trump because Mike Pence is a traitor. But Kamala Harris is on board with the government stoogery.
Right. And you can't, even if every crazy lunatic thing that Mike Pence believes were true,
right.
It doesn't fit. Section 3, I'm reading, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate. Remember, the Senate has a president.
Right.
And the vice president can step in and run the Senate. But when the vice president, you know, goes to Ukraine to shake them down, the president pro tempore is actually running the Senate. So, you know, the vice president does not have to be in Washington for the Senate to operate. But
I thought he could only be there for a tie vote, but they're not actually a member of the Senate, because I argue this too, because they're using Kamala Harris as being vice president as a voting member of the Senate, you know, which is only for ties. But they're saying because of her membership that the Democrats have a majority. But you can't use the vice president in terms of party membership.
Well, the vice president is not a member.
Right.
But he does preside, which of course has interesting parallels for, like, getting, say, Newt Gingrich to be speaker, even though he's not a member of the House.
Yeah, you don't have to be a member to be speaker. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, and you don't have to be a member of the Senate to preside over it, and in a in a, you know, train, what's the word, you know, the switching stations, you know, making the train.
Oh, transfer. Yeah, yeah.
No,
and you don't have to
they,
be
you know,
a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court, which I think is interesting too.
Right, but I mean, there's a difference between being the president of the Senate just makes the trains run on their respective tracks.
Right.
He is not supposed to, you know, vote. I mean, they don't vote as president of the House. They vote because they're a member. But it's different. So when the vice president steps in to stand in the well, he takes over as president of the Senate, but he's not a voting member except where it specifically says that he breaks the tie. But anyway, so whenever the vice president, Section 4, whenever the vice, and it's worth taking a footnote here to do this because
uh-huh,
it is
sure.
part of all this. Section 4, whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments, which is what we now would call, it's intriguing that when they wrote these things, our modern terminology and our modern structure was not exactly what they had in mind. So they call them, what today we would call the secretaries of the departments, they call the principal officers of the executive departments.
Okay, like the cabinet? That's what we're talking about, right?
Yes,
the cabinet. Okay.
But they didn't use those terms in the original Constitution.
Right.
Or such other body as Congress may law provide. Transmit to the President pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House their written declaration that the President is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't mean we don't like what he's doing. The Vice President shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting President. Thereafter, when the president transmits to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House his written declaration that no inability exists, he shall resume the power. I mean, this is
well, that's a check and balance.
I'd love to see an episode of a TV show like that. So the thing is that they can't just remove him because they don't like him. Now,
well, that's a good thing. They would have removed Trump on those grounds.
Although it says, thereupon, Congress shall decide the issue, assembling within 48 hours. So if the cabinet and the vice president say he cannot discharge his duties, and he comes back and says, yeah, I can, now Congress convenes to decide what's going on. That would be...
I just looked up the amendment. This is from February of 1967. So they weren't using old terms then. This is a modern amendment, 25th Amendment. It's fairly recent.
So I can't explain why they don't use the modern terminology. Who knows?
Must be a form thing. Yeah.
Maybe because secretary has not been introduced in the previous parts of the Constitution, but
I know
I mean,
they use Supreme Court justice and Constitution says judge. So, you know, I mean, it's very arbitrary which terms they use, apparently.
I don't know. It would have been helpful. I mean, the statutes, there are statutes about these things that do talk about secretary.
Yeah.
So the Libertarian Party is moving the file for conservatorships for President Biden and Senator McConnell, according to the New York Sun. Saying their age and mental confusion make them unfit to serve in public office and control the nation's purse string.
Yeah.
Angela McCardle is the chairwoman. But as of September 14th, they were consulting with attorneys. Now, like I say, nothing about this is precedented, but so what? But most attorneys are weenies, especially Republican attorneys. Most Republican attorneys would be like, please, Massa, can I file a lawsuit that goes against the liberal? I bow and scrape.
This must be genetic. There's something wrong here that the entire Republican, you know, the gelding old party, as I call them, the GOP, that all of them, you know, and even someone that I support, my own congressman, Matt Gaetz, you know, has not filed a real bill to do anything about any of this stuff. you know, to cancel all the funding for the Department of Justice, for example, or to, you know, remove the White House budget or take away Air Force One. I mean, the, you know, we need to isolate Brandon, you know, give him as little power as possible, because we all know that everything he does is illegal. Everything the entire administration does is illegal. There isn't an administration. We are without a government right now. We have a non-government. You know, and so, but the weenies won't even talk about that. They won't even do anything about it. That's how.
Well, I just saw something on Facebook, which uh-huh. I think has to do with somebody has a photograph of a horse tied to a flimsy plastic chair,
mm-hmm.
and and the point being that. People will restrict themselves based on habits.
Yep.
Where they start out being small enough that and it's the same thing with a elephant. They'll put a stake in the ground that a full grown elephant could easily pull out of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But when the elephant was a baby, the stake and the whatever they put around the leg was strong enough to hold him. Now he's strong enough that it can't hold him anymore. And but he's grown accustomed to a limitation that really doesn't limit him.
Yeah. We had another issue, if you want to tie this one up, Wisconsin election case that you mentioned.
Yes.
Also.
All right, thank you. So, mm-hmm. Oh God, time flies.
That's my job.
You pulled me over from the last hour. So anyway, mm-hmm. we have the Wisconsin Supreme Court, as a follow-up to a previous decision, has ruled that drop boxes, right. election drop boxes, are not legal under
now. Where were they in 2020?
Well, see that. Oh, you can't, don't. You know, shame on you. You can't. You're not allowed to draw conclusions. I studied this thing, and just like what happened in Pennsylvania. Now, in Pennsylvania, I think the Constitutional Court also ruled that
What's a constitutional
like that?
Court?
No, it was a Commonwealth Court, I guess it was.
Okay.
That the vote by mail procedures were illegal. And then the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania stepped in finally and kind of said, well, blah, 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 you know, not so much. They didn't, I don't recall that they gave a clear answer. They just sort of like, you know, what's going on? You know, they muddied the waters, but we showed with a press release from Action Radio,
right.
And by the numbers, because the votes were illegal, and everybody told them they were illegal, and long before
we declared Trump won. Remember the show we did where we declared Trump won Pennsylvania? Yeah.
Trump won Pennsylvania. Now, the thing is that the illegal votes, remember, it's not like somebody said after we lost, like, oh, let's just start saying that they were illegal. No, everybody told them months, like 6 months, 8 months ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
don't do this. It's not legal, mm-hmm. and it's grounds for fraud. And sure enough, they did it. And so now you just got to face the fact that those votes were illegal. And
what are they going to do about it? Are they going to revoke?
They said, like we argued that if they were illegal in 2022, they were illegal in 2020.
Yeah.
So we're the only ones who said, excuse me, could we just, you know, complete the circle here? Same thing with Wisconsin,
right.
That nobody wants to talk about the fact that
Brandon lost there too.
This was illegal in 2020.
Yeah.
So now the thing is I cannot find. Unlike Pennsylvania, where they clearly counted the different categories,
uh-huh.
There were about 2 million, I think 2.1 million absentee ballots, in 2022. I think 3.2 million cashed. But they did not apparently, or they don't want to tell us. I even went to the Wisconsin election website. They apparently don't really want you to know how many of those absentee ballots were put in the mail, which is really not much better in terms of election integrity, or were dropped in the drop boxes. Now, the, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that the wording of the language means that you either mail it, which, of course, is ridiculous, or you present it in person. And they said when you drop it in a drop box, there's no person. You have to present it to the clerk. And they said dropping it in a drop box is not presenting it to the clerk, and it's not in person. So drop boxes are illegal, even though it's just as bad to have reckless procedures by mail. But this is just what they did. So as a result, people put absentee ballots in the drop box instead of in the mailbox. Now this is silly. I mean, this is getting. Would you run a country like this?
Didn't check the signatures, and they didn't verify, and they just counted. So, I mean, this is all part of the plan.
Well, right.
This is the vote.
That's
product.
All
right.
True too. We got to take our wins where we can. So, Trump supposedly lost by 20,600 votes. They won't tell you how many of the votes were in the drop boxes because they don't really, they're hoping you're not going to notice. I've got two different reports. NPR Local says 570. I think Reuters, I trust a little more, says there were 528 drop boxes.
Was there an order to this? Did the Wisconsin Supreme Court order that the ballots be tossed out? Did they say you can't do it again? Was there any result of this? What did they say? What was the conclusion?
The structure of the case and of the order. Remember, judges decide what you ask them to decide, unless they don't want to, in which case they rewrite the U.S. Constitution and rearrange all of America.
I'm suspicious of judicial orders, as we know. I mean, I'm just curious what action did they
In theory, they only decide what you ask them, and unless they don't, in which case they rewrite American society. They present it as the question was in the next upcoming election, can they use drop boxes? Now I can understand the lawyer saying, look. The more we ask for, the harder it is for them to say it. You know, the more modest our ask, the better our chance of getting it.
Yeah, but you know what? Illegality is just because you're afraid to ask. I mean, just because you might. That's like when they said, well, we don't want the Second Amendment before the Supreme Court. They might rule against us. Well, they can't, unless they amend the Constitution, which they can't do either. So what are these people afraid of?
They're just afraid. But the thing is, with the Supreme Court, it's a little easier to count noses before, and you say, we don't have the votes. Let's wait until we have the votes. But anyway, so if there are 528 absentee ballot drop boxes across Wisconsin, it would only take an average of 39 per box to erase Biden's margin of theft.
Wow.
If there were an average of through the entire election season in the general election of 2020, if only 39 people per box dropped their absentee ballot box, then that would equal around 20,600 votes. It would have, the fact that clearly it's impossible for this to be illegal in 2024, but legal in 2020. I mean, there are times when it could be, but not here. I mean, none of those reasons apply here. So Trump won Wisconsin, clearly. And the reason why absentee ballots are boxes are so problematic is because well, isn't it convenient for the voter to just drop it in the box? How do you know it's the voter? You know, how
and
do you
we
know
don't
the
have to make we don't have to make voting convenient. You don't have to go to superhuman things. That'd be like saying just because we have a Second Amendment, we have to give everybody a gun so they can exercise their rights. That's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the voting
thing.
You know
what's wrong with absentee ballots?
Go ahead, Bianchi. And then I got I got a point to make on for John before he goes. Yeah, go ahead.
It's because they come under control of 50 different states. Federal government has nothing to do with no jurisdiction over absentee ballots.
That's true.
Well, the parties are national.
What do you think?
The Democrat Party is a national thing, and they coordinated the absentee ballots. So it may not
they don't coordinate the – well, I mean, in theory, they don't coordinate the rules. They coordinate the response, the activity. But, yes,
okay. All right.
What do you think – how do you think that happens, Bianca? I mean, what do you think is the significance, Bianca?
Well, the significance is that the states have a right over the control of their election. Now, the Congress can – control that federal ballot, but they let the states include it, and that's there, in fact, lies the problem, because you've got illegals voting state and local, and they can just scoot on up to the top of the ballot and put marks alongside the federal candidates. You know, you say that the United States won't become a socialist country. Yes, it will. You keep admitting people into the country who's coming from socialist backgrounds. They never will lose that.
Well, that's why they're here. Yeah.
Right.
I want to do
well,
one,
I mean,
I want
and
to,
if you,
go ahead, Jonathan. Let me get a quick thing.
But, I mean, the issue being that, you know, people may have to give up, you know, watching a football game and go down and help work with with local elections. And we do have this fetish for federal elections, and we ignore, as I think – he's saying we ignore the fact that local elections matter. You know, so we have this fetish that the only time people might consider turning off the football game to go do something is for a national election or to do something about the Supreme Court judges, when a lot of these decisions are being made locally, and nobody cares, so the people can do whatever they want.
Hmm. We did a show last week, and Bianchi was a huge part. We spent at least an hour on this, on the Brandon and Trump electors, the dual slates of electors. And Michigan and Wisconsin are two of those states. And Bianchi asked me to sort of calculate some numbers. And I don't know, Bianchi, if you were here when I did that, because I went over it last week. But electoral count, Pennsylvania has 20. Michigan has 16, Georgia has 16. So all Trump needed, you know, was 38 more electors. So if you take Pennsylvania and either Georgia or Michigan and any other state of the seven battleground states, because all he needs is two more, Trump's president. And so this is still out there. And so the courts, one of the things that they didn't do was, it sounds like they didn't, you know, call for a recount without the absentee ballots. They didn't call for anything or they didn't say to the state legislatures, you know, you guys, you know, pick the Trump electors. Those are the ones that we're going to go by. We're revoking the Brandon electors because the governor and the secretary of state can't do that. It's not their call. The Constitution gives that to the state legislature. So it looks like they once again have abdicated their duty to abide by the Constitution, and the dual slate of elector states, of which Wisconsin's one, and the fact that Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania got together, that's it. Trump gets over 38 electors by quite a bit, and technically, it's his term. So how come they didn't do that?
Well, you know, in the 2020 election, you had so much that was going wrong. One, you had a media that was feeding people as if Trump was standing up on a giant podium.
Yeah, but this was after the 2020 election. We're talking about the electors that were selected, you know, during the election, but even afterwards. They had December 14th when the electors voted, and a lot of that was fraudulent. A lot of them were barred from even voting. You had Mike Pence, who was duty-bound to send the dual slates back. You had January 6th, where Congress was duty-bound to question all the battleground state electors and make a decision which ones they were going to pick. Of course, they went for Biden because that was what the coup was all about. So there were three chances. And now we've got another chance where the court could have said, you know, that or did some kind of recount, did the schedule, something like that, or sent it back to the state legislature and said, look, you still have two slates of electors. You know, you should have the option to go with the Trump ones or the Brandon ones, given the new information on these illegal votes. And they didn't do it.
And let me say, before we run out of time,
go ahead, Jonathan.
The consequence, one of the enormous consequences of this, burying the lead till the end, is that this impacts the prosecutions of Trump and others.
Okay.
Because, you know, because they're supposedly having these fake electors and saying that the election wasn't stolen.
They're the only real ones.
We're finding out little by little that, yes, it was stolen, and yes, courts are ruling that way, and yes, Trump was absolutely correct, Trump and all the other people, to say that the election was invalid. So, I mean, in an honest system, the cases against Trump would be thrown out.
Yeah, but this is an honest system. This is a system so against Trump because he gets in the way of their system. And the courts, courts have failed along the way. I'll let you know as soon as Dorothy checks in. But the courts have failed along the way. Supreme Court, you know, was constitutionally mandated to take the Texas case. There she is. The courts were legally mandated to look at the evidence, and they refused. All along the way, the courts have completely abdicated their duties. And all these judges should be thrown off for completely abdicating the Constitution. So let me get a last comment from both of you, then I'll move on to Dorothy here. But we need to pick this up more next week because those Trump electors are still there. And it's the one thing that the Democrats have over their heads that they're trying to get rid of any way possible. Let's go Pianki, then Jonathan. Pianki, why don't you start, and then I'll get Jonathan. Then
we'll
move on to Dorothy.
I know people was expecting the courts to say one way or the other, but the courts, that's not really the court's responsibility. It's supposed to go back to the state legislatures.
But the court responsibility is to send them back. That's what I'm saying. The courts, we're duty-bound to send the electors back to the state legislatures because that's what the Constitution says.
Yeah, I agree with that. But here's another point, too. You got another big factor that's going on in this country is that people don't have the slightest idea how this works, and they react to what the news media shows them.
Yep. Agreed. Jonathan?
Yeah, no. I mean, you're assuming that the judges actually know the Constitution, but the
I'm sorry. What was I thinking?
but the thing is that if now I think so. I mean, so the thing that the judges. I mean, nobody knows how a judge makes a decision because it happens without deliberation in private and chambers, usually, things like that. But there's a lot of speculation about the fact that they read the newspaper too, and they're afraid of of political things that, you know, judges are political animals far more than they want to admit. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, the state legislatures aren't much better. You say that, you know, should the state legislature, and again, this is pathetic. They hide behind the idea that, like, oh, we can't call ourselves into session. Oh, like that? The hell you can't. So they're saying, well, yeah, but somebody would somebody just do that for us? You know, they have a Democrat governor who's not going to, or a Rhino governor who's not going to call them into session. But it is their job. It is their role under the Constitution, and they should have said, look, at least we should look at this. Come on, let's have a hearing, let's have a session, and like figure out what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're weenies, they're afraid of, you know, somebody might say something mean about them in the newspaper, and that's one of the reasons why when I helped, and Action Radio is one of the friends of the court, and Judge Thomas referred, you know, ever so briefly to our brief, but we also picked up some of the issues. Why we tried so hard to say this is a federal function, because they could say that, I mean, because the Constitution has delegated to the state legislature a federal role, not a state law role. And so the idea that, like, we have to wait until we're called into session or meet in the regular times, not when you're fulfilling a duty imposed upon you by the U.S. Constitution. Yeah. You can say, look, we have a duty to do this, we're coming into session because it's not state business. It's federal business.
Yeah, we need to pick this up next week. I'm just going to hold you up here. This is fascinating. But the Trump electors, that is the one thing the Democrats fear. That's the one thing that can throw Brandon out of office. Let's hold it there. Gentlemen, thank you. I love Mondays. This has been so much fun. Jonathan Pienke, I'll get you guys a little later. Let's get to Dorothy.
All right. Well, welcome, Dorothy, and I'll talk to you later.
Sex. Everybody talks about it. Some of you are even doing it. But are you really talking to the person you are doing it with? It all comes down to communication. That's where Dorothy Diana comes in. Dorothy is a sexual health nurse educator. She has studied hypnotherapy, Reiki, and many other disciplines. And what is sex without sensuality? Something has to light your afterburner. Join us now for a sometimes very frank and occasionally quite descriptive conversation of sex and sensuality with Dorothy Diana. And a welcome break it is. I'll tell you, that last hour was crazy. And the hour before that, we have a new reporter, Jessica Rivera. And she has, quite an extensive broadcast journalism career already. And so we're very lucky to have her. I don't know if you heard the first hour, but check it out on the podcast. But between Jessica and Jonathan, it's been pretty intense here already. So I love having you on. So now I can get a break. I can talk about different stuff. It's so much fun. Mm. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm on a very interesting, tumultuous sort of journey in my life right now. So it's full
Aren't
of
we all?
Full of adventure.
What's your
and,
tumult? Tell me your tumult. Is that a word?
It's just life. Just choice. Just every day seems very different, and there's a lot of unexpected. All of my relationships are shifting and changing. I guess this has been happening for a while.
You know why?
But I feel
you?
Like my life is just full of very new experiences, mm-hmm. and nothing is is staying the same. So it's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you right now that it's not that the relationships are changing because you're changing. I mean, this is directly you. I mean, people tend to stay the same. And if one person changes, we should talk about that in relationships anyway, because, if you have two people growing and they accept each other's growth, different though it be, that's okay. But if one person grows and the other doesn't, and they want everything exactly the same, it's like the husband says, I want you exactly the way you were when I married you. Well, and she might be 25 and now she's 55 and she's different. It doesn't work that way.
This happens and all the time. In fact,
so
I have a dear friend who,
yeah.
I have a dear friend who I met prior to his divorce. There's some people you meet and you just immediately have a lot in common. He recruits mm-hmm. for trade schools. And, I have three boys and we talked about trade schools and the changing education needs for kids and blah, blah. Got to talking about my specialty, which is relationships and intimacy and sexuality.
Right.
I somehow always find a way to get there in conversation.
Well, I hope so.
And he was,
cause I'll come back to that anyway. So yeah.
He got married when she was 21 and he was 29, and he had done quite a few things with his life, but she had only lived with her family in a different country
Ooh.
Where women live with their family until they get married, which is all beautiful. And there's nothing wrong with that. However, her growth in Gelatin was very different than his. And then he moved her here mm-hmm. and she got exposed
from where?
To our culture.
Which country?
Colombia. Colombia.
Interesting. All right. Yeah.
So once he moved her here, you can only imagine because you and I and a lot of your cohorts and mine reflect a lot on what the educational system and the culture here does to women. It's full of a lot of half lies about what's important and what men are and what they mm-hmm. should be doing. So to go through her own growth, and she grew so much, she grew way away from him and was discovering mm. herself and a type of feminism that sort of excluded him. And they ended up divorced and but what you were saying is true. She was doing personal growth, but not in an ethical way, not in a way that was a solid way for the marriage. She was growing. I think when you do personal growth, you also do it in context of how to make the relationship better, how to be a better partner, how mm-hmm. to love better, not necessarily how to find myself and hate men,
Yeah. I bet you this goes to mail order brides too, because guys who want subservient, you know, Asian women or whoever they want, and all of a sudden they come here and go, oh, I couldn't do this in my country. I want to do this here, whatever this is. And all of a sudden mm-hmm. they change. And then,
yeah, they're
going to
make friends. They're going to make friends in the apartment building. They're going to make friends pushing the baby stroller. And they're going to start talking to women, you know, that went to design school in New York, and that, mm-hmm. Which is great. However, like we've discussed, there's these sort of like pervasive lies in our culture of what it means to be a super accomplished, successful woman.
Yep.
Some of them are true and beautiful, and some of them, you know, are a little corrupting and not necessarily love-based and will separate men from women. And yeah.
So how are you changing?
The personal,
that you can talk about.
Yeah. So,
and I don't want to get too personal,
like,
but yeah.
Well, no, I'm open. You know, I went through my divorce and God told me years prior. And, you know, it was a lot of praying and a lot of preparing to do that. Mm-hmm. Not preparing strategically in the 3D, but more like breathing and praying and asking, is this right? How do I do this in flow? How do I have a wonderful, you know, like Gwyneth Paltrow called it, I love this term, conscious uncoupling, not divorce, not ex, but this person I loved and honor, how do I move away from them this way, but stay connected this way so that we're both still supported and there's the least amount of trauma possible? So I spent years preparing for that. And, you know, God told me many times it would be like an ocean wave tossing me. I would come up completely different, completely cleaned out. And so
ooh,
I'm still in that process.
Cleaned mm-hmm. out. That's an interesting choice of word. What needed to be cleaned
yeah.
out? Yeah. Just
spiritually,
curious.
Like as if there was a, I don't know if you've ever gone through energetic healing work of any kind or
probably
it's interesting
it.
Because
I've been on a journey too.
Okay,
yeah.
So going to an energetic healer who's skilled, I mean, there's a million of, it feels like everyone calls themselves an energy healer now, and I believe there are many more now than there were before, and that's a different
right.
reason the earth is ascending. However, a very skilled, experienced energy worker, you will leave the session, she's barely touched you maybe, and you leave feeling like spiritually one of those seeds has been taken over your soul and your spirit and like taken out all the garbage. Like you feel, I want to say physically high, very calm, almost like after a long fast. It's very real. And so when I say cleaned out, really the dark night of the soul, I've been through, I would say once a week, almost a dark night of a soul, or maybe it's an extended. And I'm a very radiant, feminine, happy woman by nature. This is how I came into the world this way. However, I've had a lot of my own trauma. And so this experience has allowed me to really, really get deep and pick out all the remaining garbage, because there's big plans for me. You know, I'm a caregiver, I'm a healer. I love working with women and I work with children. And so I really needed to be cleared out for my next big service. And that's done. This year has done this to me very much.
Sense.
So it continues to happen. And yeah. like you said, personal growth, like when you change, your relationship change, friends change, everything
yep.
is a reflection of who you are. Right. But the
oh,
personal
listen,
growth,
I've talked mm-hmm. about 2 years of depression, you know, pretty openly. And like I say, I always give the qualifier that I don't want to get into personal issues just because we're podcast forever. So it's always, you want to think about, you know, how much you reveal, but it's pretty common knowledge. But my depression worked for me in that it was the dark, you know, 2 years of the soul. And I was miserable. Mm-hmm. But I would not be where I am today. I would not be creating Action Radio. I would not be fearless. I would not be this, you know, masculine dude you're talking to. I would not be anything of who I am without that. And then the resulting heart surgery, because I basically woke up from heart surgery as a new person. I can't explain it. But it happened. And so, and then I changed my life, left California, started over here. And it's almost, you know, I've done that twice now, from Boston to California, completely changed everything, friends, everything changed. Left almost like a person behind, you know, or a personality
mm-hmm,
behind.
Mm-hmm,
went to California,
mm-hmm.
okay? Did everything I wanted to do there, you know, and then I was there longer than I wanted to, but I had a kid to raise, and so that was the priority. But then, all of a sudden, you know, she's on her way to college and I'm, you know, it's me and all of a sudden I'm facing things that I have never faced. And this is, see, depression is really good for people. And I know that's kind of weird to say, but it forces you to deal with things you've been refusing to deal with, and whether you medicate or ignore or just carry on with the same old patterns and the same old repeated bad relationships, it doesn't matter. You're not dealing with what you need to deal with, and your body basically shuts you down. It's okay, Greg, enough of this delay. We're going to fix you now. And then you deal with it.
Well, it's you've ignored things long enough to staying busy. And God requires you to now rest and go inward and listen. And to all the pain gets to be welcomed to the table. All the old shit that you've ignored now comes to the table. You either face it and welcome it and ask, what lessons do you have for me? And, or you could continue indefinitely. We're not allowed to escape our growth, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. And this is where medication is so dangerous, antidepressants and all that stuff. If you fail to go through this process, the rest of your life is screwed. But if you go through the process, deal with the pain, deal with the issues, face everything that you have to face, your body will eventually say, okay, that's solved. Let's go have fun. And then amazing things happen that would never happen unless you went through that process. So the dark night of the soul, I call it walking in the cave with the psychopaths. You know, so you go into this deep cave with a psychopath, and then you come out of it, and then you see the psychopaths in real life. It's like, oh, I know who you are, you know, because you've been through the cave.
You're not afraid any longer. When you go through things and you face your fears, you are not afraid. I tell my kids this, you know, we'll have certain circumstances, certain things happening in our lives day to day. You know, they're with me a lot. And I'll say, wow, I remember when I used to be afraid of that also. And you know, I tell them, the more you do this, whatever it is, join the crowd you're not sure about. Like, walk up to the group of people you're not sure about and say hello, or go on that field trip, or, you know, do that speech in front of the class. That's the only way. And once you do it, you can check. You're no longer afraid of it. Like, we're not allowed to. And I believe, you know, fear is basically Satan, whatever. I believe another name is fear. That's what keeps us from God. It's the opposite of God. And we're just not allowed to. We're not all...
There's conditioning where you're told not to try things. I remember I was flying an airplane at 16 years old. I couldn't even drive yet. I had no fear of it. Loved it. Well, certain, you know, crazy things happen in the airplanes, but I'm just talking about, but the idea of flying by myself was completely beyond fear for me. And then I got to be conditioned. And as I got older and went to college and other things happened, I won't tell you that whole story, but it's almost like my personality changed and fear came in where it never was before. And having gone through the depression later on in life, I'm back to where I was at 16, fearless. And I can do it. I mean, the limitations, I don't think I'm never going to be an Olympic pole vaulter. I'm okay with that. Okay. That's not a problem. But in terms of things that I can do, I'm playing rock and roll better. I'm playing guitar better than I've ever played in my life. I'm 60. I'm going to be 64 next month.
And I want to talk about that too, because it came up, compatibility came up this week. You know, the question, how do you choose? Well, first of all, when you enter a new relationship, how do you avoid, you know, soul-wrenching heartbreak after 6 months to a year? I mean, is that avoidable, or is it inevitable?
Whenever
you decide to put yourself out there in dating, you either are going to get married and then possibly still have soul-wrenching heartbreak later, or a series of heartbreak until you find your man. And I don't believe that's true. And I think there are keys for women, especially, to never have to experience that again. And one of them you touched on, it's called personal growth. So when you're meeting someone, when you're starting to date, one of the several keys to being very successful and keeping your feminine radiance, your excitement about life, your happiness, and not getting sucked into emotional chaos and drama and attachment is, you know, you ask certain questions towards the beginning first few days to assess compatibility. And one of them, in my estimation, needs to be how do you engage in personal growth? What are your views on like your personal growth and, you know, improving yourself and healing yourself, and just wait and don't guide and don't steer the answer. Don't maybe keep it really open. You don't need to share what you think it should be, because a man who really is enamored of you, which he will be because you're so happy and confident, you don't want to give him the answer, but the only right answer for me personally would be one that indicates healing has already been done in a major way, and it's a continued lifelong process, and personal growth is always happening, both emotional and ambition, goals in life. Because otherwise, if you have a partner that doesn't believe in personal growth, thinks everything just falls into place and your life is work, sleep, eat, watch TV, how fulfilling is that going to be to anyone with any modicum of self-confidence or sense of adventure or introspection, right?
Yeah, and my biggest problem with a lot of relationships is getting bored. don't bore me. If you bore me, I'm gone. Let me read you something.
Who doesn't engage in personal growth,
yeah,
and you do, is going to become quite boring and frustrating to you. You will no longer speak the same language in a year, right?
Agreed. I have to read you something. As you were talking, I was thinking about this, and this is a post that's going around, and absolutely makes perfect sense. It's called The Truth About Being Single. You may have seen this. This is what people don't realize is that some people are single in this generation because they are healed, which makes them incompatible with trauma bonds.
Yeah. And 90% of people are married having trauma bonds as their biggest connecting.
That's exactly what it says. So I'll get to that part. It says, unfortunately, trauma bonds are the template of our culture at this time. Those who choose peace over trauma will have difficulty in relationships because most people that we meet are emotionally damaged in some way. Peace is like paramount. If you upset my life, I don't have time for that. I've been there, done that. Don't need that. Then it says, healed people seek healthy bonds. Yeah, I'm looking. These bonds hold space for authenticity and correction. It's kind of like an oxymoron. And then this is what you said. About 90% of the relationships/marriages that we see are actually trauma bonds. Those involved, quote, need the other person to make them feel whole because they're both broken mentally, emotionally, and or spiritually. What do you think?
Yeah, and there's different amounts of this, right? So, most people, healing is a lifelong process. So I think awareness is the number one. So is this person aware of the ways in which they've been traumatized and emotionally damaged, which usually goes back to childhood? And there's so many ways. I don't expect anyone to be trauma-free. In fact, if you think you are, I don't know if you raised in a cave with Tibetans.
I don't know, but it doesn't
really exist, especially in our culture. But to be aware of the messages you were given and whether if you sifted through whether they're true or not, and how you're healing, how you've healed, what work you still have to do, and then in every discussion and any conflict, being aware in the conflict, what's coming to the table for you, what's true, what's your inner judge, what's your inner child screaming for love, and what's your full-grown adult need, and being able to process all that. Because I don't feel like there's anything wrong with two traumatized people getting together at all. It's just the lack of awareness and the lack of focus on personal growth that's really going to screw them up.
Well, it's the reaction of the trauma that makes the difference because, if we're all traumatized in one way or another, I don't think you can avoid it, especially with government schools. The whole process of schooling is indoctrination, culture, you name it. Between school and parents and society
and
money
of good
and jobs. Lack of good
sexual
sex ed,
training.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And relationship conflicts, do this, do that. You can't do too much. You can't do too little. You're normal. You're abnormal. All the pressures that go on, with kids growing, I don't think anybody can avoid some kind of trauma. It's impossible. Some of us have more than others, which means we have to work harder. And that's okay. I'm working pretty hard. But the thing is, if that's the case, then everybody has a trauma, then it's not the lack of trauma, because you're not going to find that. But what you need to find is someone that has done the healing, that has done the work, and maybe your traumas are compatible, or they're at a point where you've put them in the box. So you want to live outside the box, but the traumas are in the box, and it's like, okay, it's part of me. I recognize it. I see it. It comes out occasionally. Put it back in. But there's got to be a way to have, a successful relationship if we're all traumatized and with somebody who's not going to bring it back out again. I always say two empaths should get together.
Well, they're going to bring it back. They're going to bring it back out, and that's part of the work. I'm going to agree to be with someone who triggers me, and I want to be with someone who triggers me, not because they're intending to, just because it's going to happen. We heal in relationships, but when that trigger happens for me, and it's not them triggering me, it's my own thing interpreting whatever it is, right? So somebody very honest and trustworthy, somebody I can, somebody that's very moral and ethical, because the, one of the comforts or one of the healing requirements is that when I'm triggered, I don't have to ask, but wait a minute, could they actually be doing this sneaky, dishonest thing? Like, can I even trust this person? That has to be in place. Cause so when they, when I do get triggered, then I get to feel that and I get to say, wow, I'm feeling really insecure and scared right now. There's a part of me saying, you know, I'm not enough and I must not be enough. And
for who?
I know that's not you. Well, you, well, that's the three fears. So I'm not safe. Am I safe? Am I enough? Is there enough for me? And,
okay.
And you know, all this information. Yeah. So, yeah. So, so usually something like that is being triggered, right? Not feeling safe. Like, you know, my man stayed out later than he said he was going to with his guy friends tonight. You know, he texted me and said, hey, you know what? It's running late. I'm going to come home a little bit later, but he had said 8 o'clock and I wasn't going to have dinner with him. And I was really counting on that. That can trigger a huge avalanche of fear in someone, in a woman, that then goes into anger and then can spiral into a, like a really giant conflict. If she isn't able to say to herself, okay, you know, this does not mean he doesn't love me. This doesn't mean he's trying to be away from me. He doesn't want to be with me. It means he literally needs to recharge after a long day of work. And he's having a good time with his friends. And he let me know he's staying out late. I know he's not at a strip club. He's at, you know, he's doing fantasy football down the street at the place. And I'm, I love him and I want him to be happy. And if I insisted he comes home right now, he probably would. But is that really the solution? Is that the solution to get our relationship? Yeah. And I mean, when it all comes to fear, you know, the shadow feminine is control, right? The shadow feminine is so afraid she needs to control and devour. And so a woman who wants a really healthy, great relationship has to be able to, as soon as that feeling comes up, take a breath and pause and say, what is this? And go really deep and ask herself, because it's not him. And if you know you chose a really good man, it's not him. And if you're not choosing a really good man, that's also on you also, right? You're magnetizing that which you believe in. So,
yeah, this is, I'd say we need to do a, like a unit for guys on this, or if you ever want to put something together, because men have no clue about this, me included. This is how I know that the concern of women with safety, guys don't think about safety. I mean, yeah, personally, yeah. Do I want to walk on an open steel beam on a high building without a, you know, anything attached? No. I mean, that's personal safety. But in terms of emotional safety, that never occurs to me. It never occurs to me in the slightest, or with people I'm with, or things I'm talking about, or, you know, even in a relationship, the safety aspect, is this person making me feel safe, would never occur to me. And so I don't think guys understand this component of women at all. You know, and this is where you go back to Greg's axiom of relationships. You know, men feel secure when they're free, and women feel free when they're secure. And that paradox really dominates our relationships. And so that women have to understand that what makes men feel free, and I'm not talking about sleeping around, I'm not talking about partying all night, I'm not talking about any of that, but just the idea that they're not being controlled by women, that it's okay to do what they will do, and they will be far more supportive and far more giving and far more fun if they don't, if men don't feel like they're being controlled.
Makes sense? And there are good men that really like women and like the feminine and are at peace with the feminine, and then there are men that have been really damaged by cultural messages, lack of good parenting, being raised on pornography, lack of a father figure or any male role model. But and that's a lot of work for that man to be able to enter a good, and I like the word divine. I don't want to be all woo, but a divine sexual union, a sacred union with the feminine, that will be very challenging if there's a lot of wounding, a lot of masculine wounding, and a lot of beliefs about the feminine that are, like you said, they take over, they control, they never let you breathe, they demand, they suffocate.
But that's out of insecurity, because if it was confidence, if they felt comfortable in themselves, they wouldn't do that.
Well, like women, they might have had a mom that was like that. I mean, a man might have had a mom like that. You know, the way our parents are very fundamentally shapes how we see masculine, feminine, how we see ourselves and how we enter relationship, right? So all that has to be broken down. Everybody, there's hope for everyone as long as they do the work. And in, for me, the work, part of the essential work, is going to God. And that's where a lot of philosophies differ. I believe we cannot heal without divine connection. We can do a lot of the work, but we don't. There's a huge missing piece of alchemization that occurs, if you know, that you can't quite get without the divine connection. So, yeah.
So can people have a truly successful relationship if they have, if you have, say, an atheist with, you know, a Christian?
What does it mean successful? So what successful means something different for everyone.
One that works. One that you're together and happy. That's to me, that's a successful relationship. If you're together and you're happy and you're growing and things get better, then that to me is a successful relationship.
So what is guiding the moral structure if we are completely atheist? When I say atheist, is this somebody who believes there is no higher energy source at all? Nothing.
Yeah.
Except
so
for we're born
there is
like,
no God.
Like,
yeah. So an right? atheist, there is no, as I understand it, as an atheist believes there is no God, an agnostic isn't quite sure, and anybody who has belief in God, it's pretty well established. It's been a pretty strong force in their life, whether Christian, Jewish, you know, or Muslim or whatever, it doesn't matter.
So
that's part
it depends
of their identity.
On successful. So I'm going to say there are people who are more robotic and less emotional than others. And just really consider success. There are people out there that their emotional range is very small, and they neither experience great joy nor great sadness, and really they feel enough fulfilled. And I have my own hypotheses of why, but I don't feel it's really living a full life. But we're all called differently. We're all coming to this earth differently with different callings. So I'm not to judge. But happy and successful means different things for different people. I know someone who feels, you know, that his calling is to, you know, just take care of his kids, and he doesn't care if his job has any meaning whatsoever. He doesn't care if he gives back to the community. He doesn't care, you know, any of those things that those happiness studies say give real happiness.
Happy,
he doesn't really ascribe
happiness.
To that.
That's a whole topic. Sometimes we should talk about happiness. What you know, real as opposed to imagined, as opposed to false. That'd be a whole fascinating discussion.
So there's something I'm going to say in my opinion and experience. There's something that's missing. It's almost like you serve a pie, but you didn't use like any spices. You use just kind of frozen, store-bought, you know, non-organic because they don't have as much flavor. They're grown in mass fields that are used over, so they don't have as many nutrients. It tastes different. It's bland. Just a pie that's made from really just generic.
Or like a pie crust with nothing on it.
Ingredients.
No cheese, no sauce. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, versus a homemade pie by Granny where it's flaky and she takes forever with the crust and she adds, you know, special spices to the berries and extra flavor and,
well,
you know, maybe
love.
She uses lemon. She has those secret ingredients.
There's love in that pie. Yeah.
Yeah. And the berries are picked from the yard, which tastes very different. I know because I have berry bushes. And so I feel that I'm just going to say what I've seen is that living with an atheist, engaging with them feels like the first kind of pie. It's like there's some big human thing missing, like a richness, a vulnerability. Can they have success? Well, yeah, sure. I mean, it depends. It, defining success, you know, if you define success the same way that your partner defines success, then you're happy, right? But I think it's very, I think one of the biggest, not I think, statistically, it's a huge red flag if the spiritual beliefs and religious beliefs aren't aligned going into a relationship. I mean, you can't, it's doable, but it's very challenging.
This being Yom Kippur, we should probably recognize that.
So, yeah, it can happen, but it's one of those things that people end up in counseling about and destroys a lot of relationships later. Because if you identify with a higher power and you're submitting to a higher power's guidance for your life, that's a hugely different life than, you know, our service to self culture life.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. Well, it gets back to your original question of personal growth. you know, where we started this. I hope this is your topic that you want to talk about, because we've been spending, you know, the better part of the hour already on it. But
yeah,
personal
it wasn't
growth
really,
involves...
but I'm always in flow here.
Yeah, me too. But personal growth, spiritual growth is a huge part of personal growth, especially if you get closer to God in the process. And that's empowering. And I think people that don't, you know, I feel for the atheists and agnostics, because how can I say this? You don't know what you're missing. You know, there is, it is an extra part of you that if it's not there, it's, there's definitely something missing. And you can be happy. You can work hard. You can do your job. You can, you know, pay your bills and, you know, do all that kind of stuff. But there's a certain emotional content to your life and your soul that just isn't there unless you have
right.
a higher power. And why would anybody be so arrogant to think that they are the higher power? That's the part I don't understand.
Yeah, I agree. And it really just takes one major tragedy to turn almost everyone into a prayer. And I believe God will tap people. If you're called, you're not escaping it. And I do believe mm-hmm. that we are all on the earth for different reasons right now. And you may be having a time in your soul journey where you're allowed mm-hmm. to just rest and ignore for a short time, I guess. But mm-hmm. I believe God taps us. And asks us, and if we don't listen, then we get met with tragedy sometimes. Something so deep that you fall on your knees and you beg anybody who's listening, and then grace comes in, and all of a sudden you're touched. That seems
I hear
to
that.
A lot.
I hear that with folks on the show. Wendy talks about that. She does her Oh My God report. I was listening to John Voight on with Tucker Carlson, and he was just, his life was destroyed, and he had drugs and all these other problems and things like that. And he's like, you know, he talks about being on the floor, in his kitchen floor, like on his hands and knees saying, God, why is my life so tough? And God tells him, it's supposed to be tough. I'm like, oh, okay, that makes
yeah.
sense. You know, and
yeah.
once you realize that your life is supposed to be tough, you're supposed to have challenges.
Yeah.
That's what makes us great. That's what makes us better. That's, you know, and I understand that completely. I mean, I look at all the things that happened in my life, you know, the good and the bad, if I can quote a movie. But each one of them plays a part in where I am now. And you don't see that because, you know, God sees the end of the chapters, but you don't. You're still writing the individual chapters, and you don't see the whole puzzle.
That's why journaling is really, really important. You can go back in
yeah.
a year. And remember your thought processes and remember what you've been through and be proud of yourself. And not only that, not make the same mistakes again. So mm-hmm. I feel like journaling is crucial to really expedite the personal growth and not,
yeah.
you know, get enmeshed in the same situations over and over. But yeah, I agree completely. And another component that I feel like, so suffering is much alleviated when we have support. When we feel like we can reach out to our group of people, everybody, and be like, I'm having a very hard time, help. I'm having a very hard time, help. And what do you need? Don't ask what I need. Just come help. Just
yeah.
whatever. And then you know that people will bring you food, give you a hug. I'm here for a phone call. How can I help? You know, do you want me to go pick up your dogs from the groomer? Like whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
we're supposed to have that. And this, these processes don't have to be so painful and so confusing. We're supposed to be doing it in community, you know?
Yeah.
With wisdom.
And I think that's one of the big problems is thinking you can solve all this stuff on your own. That's a pretty big burden for people to take on. It's almost arrogant in a way. Marco said something interesting. So he's listening in Netherlands. He says, my parents are Catholic, but I'm an atheist, but I don't consider myself less human. Marco, I don't consider yourself less human either. I don't consider anybody less human. However, I still think, but there still can be something missing. What would you say that it's going
to show? It's really hard to explain because I've gone through a period of atheism in my life. And this isn't my specialty, so I probably should be talking about it. I'm only saying when I ask my heart to reflect on when I'm interacting with an atheist versus a person who has a prayer meditation practice. I don't care what they're calling it. One of the prayers I like to have is higher light beings, all beings of the highest light, ascended masters, you know, Yeshua, who clearly walked this earth and was some sort of spiritual being very close to God and did the blood mm-hmm. sacrifice, which is a universal.
We're talking Jesus, right?
Very magical, yes, very magical, without meaning a dark connotation of the word magic, but a very magical universal mm-hmm. phenomenon, blood sacrifice for others. There is
yeah.
something so powerful on that. So that was all real. I use all these broad terms, but to have nothing is very sad. Even Einstein, you know, admitted there is some sort of energy that we don't know, and there's some sort of thing to tap into. It's almost like a love energy. And, you know, my uncle was a theoretical physicist and also very,
really,
very, very atheist, very atheist. And even he said one day, cause I kept pressing him. I was like, and he said, well, there is this light spectrum and it's here. And then there's the frequency we know is here. And then he spread his arms out really wide and said, and theoretically what we know exists is here. Nobody knows what it is. And there's a lot of evidence there's some sort of force out there that is intelligent. And so that was an interesting conversation. And I'm not trying to disparage anyone because we're all on a different path. However, having no energy source outside yourself that is whatever you want to call it, positive light energy or something to connect with, I don't know, there's just a difference in how you move through the world and how you vibrate and your frequency. Mm-hmm. And again, nothing's right or wrong, and we're all on a different path. It's just for me personally, miracles happen, and whether you could say, oh, you're manifesting it yourself or it's coincidence, whatever. When I connect, when I listen, when I ask, when I move in the way that I'm supposed to towards myself and others, miracles really do happen, like crazy stuff in my life that can't be explained. And again, that,
yes, it can.
You know,
that's
a
weird part.
Someone who's trying too hard to go with science and trying too hard to explain things away can talk about coincidence and talk about I created it or whatever. I don't know. But when you know, you know. And again, I don't think that any of that really makes an atheist feel better, what I'm saying. But like I said, I've been there. I've been there. I left many years ago and came back. But
well, there's a certain letting go that I think if you don't have God, you have to maintain control of everything. And that's impossible.
Yeah. Ooh,
and so it's a very difficult path to
Can
walk.
Can you imagine?
But no, I've never been atheist. I was definitely agnostic. It's like, you know, I'm not sure about God. You know, and, you know, my life's been pretty crazy. I mean, if, you know, and there was a question, if God were, you know, really impacting all our lives individually, you know, why is this happening? Why did the Holocaust happen? Well, because people let it happen. You know, and so there's a whole.
Well, because we're on a.
Yeah. You know,
this is a 3D. Yeah. We're not in the 5D, 12D structure. We're in a 3D. Mm-hmm. This Earth has been very oppressed. There are definitely dark entities here. You can call them reptilian, you can call them demons. I don't care what you call them. Mm-hmm. That's real. So that's why Holocaust happens, because wars are crafted. Even if you don't want to talk about God and spirituality at all, we have RFK Jr. talking about the wars are crafted. They're crafted by these groups, Vanguard, you know, State Street and BlackRock. That's who creates the wars. And here's the proof that they do it. And there's so much evidence. So even if they're like, well, there's nothing God, nothing spiritual, to imagine anybody who could do a Holocaust isn't human. Whether you say, oh, they've lost contact, you can say there's brain dysfunction, maybe part of their brain, you know, who knows? But that's not how humans come into the world. If you ever worked with children, they're so connected, giving, loving, pure, all of them. The only difference we're seeing is severe vaccine damage where there's no social connection whatsoever. The eyes kind of go blank. They stop connecting with other people. But that's intentionally done also, I believe. But even if that's not God. That's dark entity. And that's because our planet is under that rule right now. And I think we all can feel that, you know.
Well, I think that's part of why I think we're so suppressed, oppressed, and censored here at Action Radio, because we talk about these things. And we talk about things that, you know, I just had Jessica on the first hour, and she's telling about the things that you can't, you know, say on broadcast news. And I said, well, that's why we're here. We're here to say the things that can't be said on broadcast news. That's the point, you know, and that's part of being fearless, and we just do what we do. You have three things. You have BlackRock, you have Vanguard, because I want to look into this more. I'm going to find out what RFK said. I want to get like a transcript of YouTube or something. So what were the three? BlackRock, Vanguard, what was the third one?
And I believe it's called State Street. That's what my son, I could never remember that one because my bank is South State, so I get it mixed up. And so my oldest son was like, yeah, I know it's State Street.
Okay, good. I'm going to check all three. This is interesting. But, mm-hmm. yeah, if we're in a 3D world, and people, like I said, the spiritual world is not a 3D world. You know, but that's what faith's all about. Belief in God is believing in things that you know are true, but you can't prove it. You know, because we are in a 3D world. And it's fascinating that scientists like Einstein, as they get older and they start seeing, huh, there's no other way to explain what they're finding other than God, other than an intelligent force, an intelligent design. My question to folks, you know, atheists or agnostics, is, well, you know, what keeps the electrons from running into each other and the universe collapsing? Well, I don't know. Okay, well, there's got to be an intelligence out there, you know, that does that. I mean, who's managing the electrons? Who's managing the quarks, you know, the subatomic nuclear particles? Who's doing that over the course of universes, you know? And they
yeah,
found...
and you can tap into that. You can tap into that no matter what you want to call it. You can tap in.
Yeah.
And when you tap mm-hmm. in, your body has a feeling. It's that that tingling in the arms and the feet. It's that energetic feeling that is divine energy. And
yeah,
and
I know
I think
that feeling.
The word, yeah. I think the word triggers people, and I understand why it does. You know, I was raised in the Catholic Church. Getting beyond the words God, and I've come back to the word God. So I actually didn't use it for a long time because I'm at peace with everything now. I'm like, oh yeah, it's all just trickery. Like you know, really just a very damaging upbringing with religion, and it's so tied into sexuality. When you shame mm-hmm. sexuality and the sexual organs, which is the same life force energy that created the world and created humans and created everything mm-hmm. beautiful, that same energy is in our genitals. That same energy is sexual energy. It's been corrupted also. So just like the Holocaust, there is rape. So that is taking a beautiful energy and twisting it intentionally. And then that also shames and suppresses and puts fear and shame into humans' hearts, which is the opposite of divine energy. And now you've incapacitated us, you've castrated us completely. So what I work with is increasing feminine radiance, increasing divine feminine energy through reclaiming sacred sexual energy through somatic movement. And it works and it's beautiful. That is a tiny mm-hmm. piece of it, but it tries to untell the stories. It tries to retell the stories, explain that what we were told, and help us understand why we were told that and why it's a lie and how we can retell our stories as divine sexual sacred creatures that our life are full of life force. And there's no room for shame in God's eyes. There's no room. You know, the vulva and the vagina are like mini universes, mini cosmos. And they are to be revered, and they are to be worshipped, and they are to be honored and sacred. And we have that disgusting feeling our culture gives us about them instead. That's intentional. And so that's people feel the same way about their own sexuality frequently as they do about God and the word God. And they say, oh, it's all religion. Oh, it's all religion. Oh, it's all lies. It's all, you know, it's repulsive, right? When the mm-hmm. opposite is true, it is actually life force. And when you take a breath and enter in, and say, I've been told a lot of lies. Show me the truth, God. Show me the truth, divine energy. Show me the truth, energy that keeps, whatever you want to call it, the energy that keeps electrons from colliding. Show me your truth. I mean, you can start with anything. The labels don't matter.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Oh, that's just an example use. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with the women, we start with, you know, touch your shoulder, touch your knee, touch your breast. And when you feel that blockage to put your own hand on your breast, okay, that's interesting. Let's be curious. Let's not judge it. Let's not react. Let's wonder why we cannot put our hand on a certain body part without a feeling of shame or resistance or repulsion. And that's real.
Huh.
It starts with little steps, but that is part of the journey. And I don't know. I think it's beautiful.
You know, it's fascinating. I think I mentioned this before. Most of the reporters to this show are women. I really like engaging with and it's not a sexual thing, at least I don't think so, but there's an energy between men and women that is different. And I love the dudes on the show. I mean, they're fabulous. And we just had Jonathan and Pianchi in the hour beforehand. But it's different, and I wonder how strong, you know, sexual energy or just the energy that men and women create. You look at the discussions we have. How often are you going to find discussions like we talk about? We're pretty open here, you and me, the way we talk about stuff. But I wonder, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, why is it I have three times as many women reporters as men on the show? I didn't plan it. I like it, you know, because I like engaging with women. But what does that say?
I don't know. What do you feel like it says?
I
think you're very comfortable. I think you're comfortable in your masculine and you love the feminine.
Yeah, I do. I think I think I really just like engaging with women. You know,
and you're
tapped
into your own feminine, you know?
Must be. My kid used to accuse me of that. You're getting in touch with your feminine side again, Dad. And it's like, what feminine side? You know, now I understand what she's talking about. And she was like five or whatever the young age.
It's just creativity. It doesn't mean womanly. Yeah. It just means that energy
well,
that's more receptive, creative,
yeah.
Not necessarily linear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's part of understanding it, that when we talk about masculine and feminine energy, we're not talking about men and women, and we're not talking about good and bad. It's just, you know, just if you're a dude doesn't mean you don't have feminine energy. I think it's good to have a lot of both. I mean, I think I have more masculine just because I'm a dude. But there's a strong, I guess, feminine energy side that allows me to be as communicative as I am. Because we always hear, well, guys can't really communicate. Oh, yeah? Listen to this show. We communicate all the time, you know, on many different levels and many different times. I just find it interesting. You know, I thought about it the other day. I said, looking at my schedule. Oh, that's interesting. And so you'd be the person to ask.
We have been all over the place in this conversation. Mm-hmm. I think it's funny. Yeah, no,
yeah,
I
well,
came in intending to talk about.
That's
well,
normal.
You know, I didn't. Yeah, I was. My original feeling was. And, you know, I always talk about things that are personal to me in my life because I'm selfish that way.
That's not selfish.
What is feminine radiance and what is – why do we have women walking around so buttoned up, so unhappy? And, you know, I love to listen to Stephen Speaks every now and then. I think he's really great, so if I have time. And, you know, he's mentioning – he's a wonderful online relationship counselor, long dreadlocks. Really helps women. He's very masculine, but he knows how to speak to women, which is really important. And you know, so he can kind of advocate. He understands.
But those go together. If you are really masculine, I think you have a better chance of speaking to women. If you're more feminine, you know, this probably too much is similar. You can't see the difference. But by being masculine and talking to women, I think that makes perfect sense to me.
Well, he speaks to them in a way that's very honoring and totally understands why they do what they do, you know, because we women be crazy, right? Especially we haven't
I've
done our healing
yep.
work. We are very chaotic. Oh, I've had a very crazy week. The man in my life could attest to that, like hot, cold, up, down, all over the place.
I don't want to get him on, but I'd love to get him on. He'd be fascinating to have on the show, but like I say, we don't want to get too personal here. But that would be just the dynamic.
The funny thing is,
really interesting.
And women process by talking things through, right? And the emotions are very volatile frequently.
What
so
does that say?
He gets to hear, a different mood every hour. But but I'm working on that. I'm doing much better. This week. So really, what was on my mind was more, you know, the internal work of that women unfortunately have to do in our culture to undo all the messages, and this creates this amazing radiance of love. And excitement of life and also a huge amount of forgiveness, compassion, and connection, giving men especially the benefit of the doubt, understanding men and why they're a little bit different, and being able to be in relationship really in the most beautiful way, you know, and a little bit on how do you not have that drama in relationship, and it all goes together. But first we undo the messages we were given, and then we step back into this beautiful feeling of radiance, which comes from a lot of self-care and connection. And only then do we enter relationship with understanding men deeply, what they need, and how they're different than women. So it's a huge topic, but what got me on this topic was picking up the book Vagina by Naomi Wolf and revisiting that, and she goes into just the eons of cultural messaging. And we've heard this, but it's when you read about it, it really is very profound. The eons of cultural messaging against women, sexuality, and empowerment. And again, I love men. I'm not, I guess, really a feminist, but that's very real. And today, the women living today are still products of these belief systems of their sexuality and their feelings. And it's really very still repressed, even from the word the C-U-N-T, and people use it in a very derogatory word, that's painful. When that happens, women have learned to ignore it, because if we say, oh, that word's offensive, now we're sort of, oh, we don't get it, we're not cool, it doesn't mean anything, but it does. It has an energetic meaning. You know words cast spells. I do also. There's a lot of energy behind words. And even our use of that as an insult, or P-U-S-S-Y as an insult, speaks volumes. We are steeped in this soup as women since we're born. And I can give a million examples of why we have women in our culture, full-grown adults, who aren't able to be fully present in their own bodies and with men. And if we can heal that, we've won. The real humans have won.
Yeah, and the men will be eternally grateful, because, you know, guys in relationships have to face this too. So the conditioning that conditions women is something that guys have to deal with as well. So not only will you free women,
also have it.
They also embody
that conditioning. They don't just have to deal with the women. They also have the same belief system frequently. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the major problems is conditioning. It's like we start off, you know, being born pretty good, and up through about five, we're still, you know, kids and we can do what we want. But when the conditioning starts coming in, you know, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there, then we have to be unconditioned. So you spend half your life being conditioned, you know, then you have to spend the rest of your life being, unconditioning yourself.
It happens way before that. I hate to say this, and this might sound to a newer listener as a little extreme, but even as much as when you change the baby's diaper, so babies, if you know, they do mirroring, they look at your face all the time when they're healthy. When they're neurologically damaged, I say it's mostly from vaccines, you don't see that as much. But a healthy, really alert baby makes tons of eye contact all the time. They're always looking at our faces to check in, right? So changing a diaper, you look down at their genital area and you make a grimace, ugh, right? That in itself is a message. It starts,
really?
I'm telling you, it starts.
Wow.
Baby puts the hands in the diaper area and starts twiddling. Now, see, I have three boys, and I will never forget when my oldest, he would be mortified.
Caution.
It's
caution
so cute.
Alert.
Okay. Right. Well, they love their genitals, and they're proud of them. They don't have a sense of shame. We give that to them, and it just made my heart break when I saw it happening. You cannot protect the kids from being shamed by somebody sooner rather than later about, you know, nakedness and being proud of their body. And can we just let them run around naked and just everywhere in public? No, our culture doesn't allow us, but you know, there are cultures that do, many, that children aren't clothed until they're much older. So even the act of clothing certain parts of the body is a message. Does it have to be traumatic? No, but there's much worse messages they get also. So it starts very young. A four-year-old puts their hand down their pants and starts giggling because there's sensations there. There's a lot of – it's like being tickled in the armpit or like having your head scratched. It feels good. That area has a lot of nerves. It feels good.
So they don't distinguish.
And it's not even sexual.
So that's interesting. I never thought about this. But, yeah, if one place tickles and the other place, you know, tickles to them, it's the same thing.
Well, it's a different sense of tickling. Just like your head being scratched is different than – you know, if somebody was tickling your armpits or rubbing your feet, but it all feels just delicious and wonderful, just like a nice bowl of warm soup or a brownie from grandma. These are all wonderful feelings about being in the world, running through the warm grass with your bare feet. But this act got a disapproving look from my teacher a disapproving look in the best case scenario, right? Doesn't that feel good? Now go, you got to wash your hands after we do that though. And then later say it's more of a bedroom activity, you know, again, to have the child fit into our culture, right? There are ways to respond that guide them for correct behavior, but also give the freedom and not a shame. So we come as adults, there's so many of these and they happen every single day. So no wonder we're completely cut off and ashamed and really repress the best of us about sexuality and living super holy into who we actually are, letting all the feelings have a place, letting all the parts of us are welcome to the table and we're super proud of them, and we know that they serve a great purpose. That's the goal, and it takes a long time to get there.
Yeah, interesting.
But if both people are on that journey, well, here we go. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about from the beginning to the hour. That's the personal growth. And if one is and one isn't, you know, you can kind of see where that's going, right?
I can, but I want to explore the whole idea of sexual energy more, because we think of energy as, you know, cardio, you know, and bike riding and hitting the gym, you know, energy to, you know, run the show or be creative or have ideas. And as I am fond of saying now, you know, God sows these ideas in my head. I'm just a messenger, because I don't believe that one person could have as many ideas as I do. That's just not normal. So the rational side says that's not normal.
I know what you mean.
So the only explanation could be, this is God inspired. It's like, thanks God, appreciate the help, you know, which I say on a regular basis. But the idea of sexual energy, it's not just sex. And I think that'd be something fascinating. Here's no time to explore, you know, for one of our weeks here. But the idea of that, and I think if we can sort of not harness but direct your sexual energy to wherever else it is, or even sex. There's a whole, I think, unexplored. It's almost like you can talk about sexual energy, but you can't use it there. But, you know, it's not really the good energy. The good energy is working hard and being creative and keeping your nose to the grindstone. But the sexual energy, that's like touching your genitals. This is like the, you know, which at four, like, who cares, right? You know, but there's something, I think we're missing an explanation. Has this ever been studied? Has anybody really looked into sexual energy that helps you build buildings or makes you fearless or brings you closer to God?
Yes.
Or all these other things.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
It absolutely has been. And
this
I'm going to give
I
you, so I went through, well, there's a lot of people who have studied this. That does not make mainstream culture. I think the same reason proof of prayer in healthcare, which is real. And I am not ascribing to any certain religion, although I yes, probably most closely identify with Christian, certain branches of Christianity especially, but this is not a Christian perspective. This has been, like, Chinese scientists have done the study completely.
Oh, it's not limited to Christian perspectives, except when Wendy's on.
A curious way, like, does prayer affect healing for surgery? Does prayer actually heal the body? And the answer is 100% yes. And working as an ICU nurse, I saw it over and over and over. And these older Filipino nurses would say, if you can't get the IV stick, say a quick prayer. I learned that in the first month. And this is back when I was a wild something 20-year-old, and I really wasn't very prayerful at all. I was going through an interesting time in my life. But when those older Filipino nurses who were excellent, were training me and told me that, I believed them because I saw how successful they were with patients. And so I was like, okay, a little prayer for the IV stick. Sure enough, a little prayer for the IV stick works every time, because there is a divine source that wants us to help and heal. There's a divine energy. That energy, whatever you want to call it, wants us to do good acts and doesn't give a crap what we call it. And that is part of the exclusion that religion does, is saying, if you don't call divine source energy this, you're going to hell. If you don't call divine source, no, it is huger than that. And part of the hugeness is the sexual energy. Absolutely. I can tell you this right now. I'm going to sound like a crazy lady to some people. I'm going to say it anyway.
No.
I can do hip circles in the way that I teach it. And the way I teach is with a sort of mentality. Well, you stand with your feet spread and your knees are a little bent, and you start circling your hips the way women have done since the beginning of time in spiritual ritual and in happiness and in celebration.
Okay.
And if you ever go to Carnival in different countries, what I'm talking about, this movement I'm talking about, you'll see there. But it's just a big old hip circle. It feels so good. And when you're doing it, you are actually calling on this energy in your body that's so delicious and fun and radiant and excited. And it is your pelvic energy. It's your sacred chakra energy. And you can take that hip circle energy and all of a sudden shoot it out towards something. And I've had friends do this. We have tried this over and over. It works. And you will actually make equipment work that wasn't working. You will change someone's mood like that. There's so – it is real. And there's been books written about this. I would say Pussy by Regina Thomashower is a good one to pick up. She's Mama Gina. She's got Mama Gina's women's art school.
You should bring these
folks
on the show,
the arts.
Like Naomi Wolf and some of these others. It'd be great to talk to them.
There have been lots of science about prayer and also sexual energy causing huge changes, absolutely changing lives. But it's a deep secret, because if we teach people this, If people know how to do this, Joe Dispenza, manifestation, that's just another way to call on that divine energy. It's the same thing.
Okay.
And he has millions following him because it is life-changing. When I went to one of his retreats, almost everyone I met there was literally living their best life. They weren't faking it. I know the women. I was invited to the Cayman Islands resort she owns. I was invited to to the volcano outside Cartagena where he made a healing retreat. These people have taken this channeling of the energy and they have absolutely, like, it's nothing short of a miracle, and it is God, and it is in our pelvis, and it is in our heart, and it's in our throat, and in our head. And every part of our body has a different energy center. It's referred to as chakras sometimes, but and they all have a little bit of a different flavor of what they do and how they call, but that doesn't even matter anyway. Any one of them is connected, and you can channel and you can ask from any one of those areas. I mean, it's amazing what's available to us when we wake up and do the work, the personal growth, and begin to tap in to what we really have and what we can really connect with and begin to make this stuff happen in our lives. But yeah, sexuality is a huge part of it.
Yeah,
and it's
this
not
is
sex,
fascinating.
Like you said, it's not sex, not the act
no,
of sex.
No, it's the energy.
It's the energy of that region. And if you put your energy there right now and you sort of focus on it and you'll feel this warmth in that area and you start to feel it and you feel it spread out to your hips and you just feel like this sort of heavy bowl of energy, that is it.
Wow.
And it's not, quote, horniness.
No, I want to go loop airplanes right now. This is where I think my energy comes out in airplanes, okay? So I want to loop airplanes and fly really fast jets. I've always wanted to do that.
Yes, I
keep getting denied and sidetracked and stuff like that. But I think flying is sexual energy. I'm telling you right now, you get that throttle and you start rocketing off into the sky, especially at weird angles, it's like pure sexual energy that isn't sexual. Does that make any sense? I mean,
major potency.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's definitely a guy thing. I think more men are pilots. But some really good women pilots too. I've trained them. That's just my personal experience. But there's a lot of really good women pilots. But the sexual energy, the idea, again, you know, if a guy has a you know, in touch with feminine energy, that doesn't make him identify as a woman. Nothing could be further from the truth. So we need to almost give these disclaimers so people misunderstand. But I think sexual energy. I'm even talking faster now. I'm still thinking of the airplanes. This is huge. So what's the guy equivalent of hip circles?
I think guys can probably do it too, but if you go back, that's a very feminine energy movement because the hips are the life-giving.
Right.
My guess for guys, and I've thought a lot about this because I would love to work with men in the movement also, think of a push-up. Think of a hip thrust. Think of taking your fist and punching it up into the air super high, like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Think of that kind of movement.
I think movements, I'll tell you right now, just I think movements that make guys feel big, and I don't mean sexually big, but I mean like arm stretches, you know, just making you feel a larger being. I know when I'm in an airplane, and this is something I talked about with students. I said, you know, we're up here in the sky, you know, we're part of something much bigger. When you're on the earth, you feel very small. But when you fly an airplane in the sky, you feel big. And because you're covering this massive, immense area. I mean, the whole sky is, you're a part of the whole sky. That's really big. But if you're on Earth, you're part of a little patch of ground. It's an entirely different thing. And I never thought of it as sexual energy until 10 minutes ago. But it makes sense. What do you think?
Yeah, it's really very cool. And even someone, you know, who's an atheist, if they can even process it that way, I think that's enough. Like, instead of thinking of it as God or religion, think of it as your sexual energy. And if you can begin there, that's going to start to unfold a lot.
Yeah, this is very interesting. There's got to be, a guy equivalent. It might be hip circles, but it's hip something. Because, you know, our organs, our male-female organs are in the same place. They're just different.
Well,
but obviously there's something. Okay, I'll let you
know. I got excited.
Yeah, me too. This is fun.
a plank position, and then let your hip come down and up in that plank position. And see what that feels like and see if that feels, and maybe even a push up and then a hip thrust and a push up and a hip thrust staying in a plank position. It's going to be very strengthening and,
might come in handy.
Yeah,
sorry.
Of course. Yeah. It's conditioning. Well, women want that. Women don't want you collapsing on them after 5 minutes. It takes a lot of strength. A lot of women love that position in bed. And so a lot of men get super tired, their arms get tired. And so it's important to keep those muscles up. we don't want to always get on top. You know what I mean? That's a lot of work too. So, okay.
Oh, I think variety. Well, like everything else, you know, like the buffet is, this, you know, variety is the spice of life. So we haven't talked positions yet, but we should definitely, that'd be a great chat too. I mean, we can get pretty direct here.
I think we did position. Like a year ago, but it was very brief.
Oh, nothing about sex should be brief. That's rule number one. So, you know, whether we're talking about
unless it's a closet quickie on your lunch break.
Okay, that's true. Yeah, we did that. We did the office. We did the sex at work chat. So we need like a checklist. Where have we talked about sex? You know, we haven't gone public transportation. You know, park benches at night. That's actually a true story. I'll tell you, either on or off the air. But different places. It's fascinating. You know, sex in the woods. You know, car seats. It's just, but there's so many places we can go with this report. There really is no limit, especially when you consider the energy aspect. I bet you if you listen to the show, how we were talking, you know, half an hour ago compared to how we're talking now, we're talking faster now. We've got that energy. We've got our own energy going, and
I feel it too.
Yeah, well,
I feel it too. And my kitties are waiting for me. I'm going to give them some French toast.
Okay, contact information. We'll do it next week.
And
but,
the
kids.
French teacher just arrived.
Bonjour, comment allez-vous?
All the things. Yeah. Oh, bonjour, monsieur. So.
Well, merci for this week. We'll do it again.
So many topics. My head is spinning. And, my contact, Dorothy Diana on Facebook. And I just started, I'm very unprofessional because I'm very, you know, casual about my business, really.
I take clients by word of mouth.
I'm very
instinctive. Yeah.
But I will say I just finally have my own Facebook page for my business. So there's got like 5 likes on it because I haven't even told anyone about it. But I'm going to start posting all my business stuff on there because it is very highly sexual in nature. And now I'm in the dating world and it really it puts a message I don't want to put out there right away. So Yoni Yoon is now my separate Facebook page. I'm going to try to post all my naughty things on.
Ooh.
Our report. Really,
you
naughty.
Have to get
our report
on. We get pretty naughty on the port, so I mean that's definitely got to be there. You're probably more liked than on my page. I'm still restricted, you know. So yeah.
I mean, I cover so many things, and my emphasis is really on spirituality. But you know, when you're in the dating world and you're single, I love men, but they only need like a little hint, like, oh, she talks about sex, you know, to put the minds there. And I really want to emotionally connect first. I don't want to present myself that way in the dating world right away. It just doesn't really work well. So my page is Yoni Yoon now, but I'm also Dorothy Diana on Facebook, and I'm on Instagram, and I teach on Zoom online, and I also teach group classes. We do somatic sexual healing, a very gentle trauma-informed, super fun movement practice that is very healing and reignites sexual energy, sinking us back into our divine feminine to go out in the world with amazing radiance. Mm-hmm.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you again, as always. I love talking to you. And as I say in Star Trek, boldly go where no person discusses, you know, before. So here we are.
Yeah. So important.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. I'm going to bike to my coffee shop after I make French toast. That's my plan for the day. And you have a great week, and I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Thank you again, Dorothy. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Bye now. Here is your Action Radio contact and website information. The call-in line is 215-383-3832. Our show site is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Same link, live and a podcast. Please share all our shows. We have live chat at the bottom of the broadcast page available worldwide. Sign in to your free account and type away. We have an internet Skype line where you can call the show worldwide also. Please see the broadcast page for our Skype name. Call in during the show to get approved. Our bill writing site is writeyourlaws.com, WRITEYOURLAWS, writeyourlaws.com. This is where anyone can write a bill and start the process of it becoming law. My paid and free subscription column is at gregpenglis.substack.com. Please consider a paid subscription of $5 per month or greater. For contributions to Action Radio, please go to givesendgo.com/actionradio. We have over 20 Action Radio Facebook groups. Use the Facebook search window by putting in Action Radio
to find our groups. My public email is greg@writeyourlaws.com. Please contact me about advertising on Action Radio and helping our mission of freedom. Thank you for listening. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. Well, that sounds good. Even better. Okay, how about your car? If you want the best service for your vehicle, please talk to James at Florida Stores Automotive, conveniently located at 6715 Caroline Street in the historic district of Milton, Florida, right between the Milton Bakery and the Blackwater Trail. Whether you need an oil change or an entire engine replaced, this is the place. The phone number is 850-623-6651. That's 850-623-6651. Call, ask questions, and get the information you need. Florida Stores Automotive is a full-service automotive shop for both domestic and imports, modern and classic. It is a family-owned business here in our Milton community. Open weekdays from 7:30 to 5 p.m., Florida Stores Automotive is a convenient place to keep your car maintained and on the road. Ask them about Firestone tires and the rotation and maintenance plan. Florida Stores Automotive. I go there. You should too. Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Grace Care. And now as an affiliate of Grace Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Grace Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is gracecare.com. That's GRAITHcare.com. You can email them at gracecare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7149. That's 469-864-7149. Grace Care, better health through better knowledge and advocacy. This is Greg Penglis for Strikeforce, your source for pure energy. Strikeforce is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. You make your energy drink yourself. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strikeforce, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strikeforce is at StrikeforceEnergy.com. That's StrikeforceEnergy.com. Start your engine. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.